Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science, where their new exhibit, Changing Landscapes, An Immersive Journey, transports you to iconic spots around the globe to see how people are adapting to a changing climate. More at mos.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, who's the biggest threat to President Trump, the surging Senator Elizabeth Warren or the whistleblower? On today's Politics Roundup, we go over the Ukraine bombshell, Markey's challenge to Joe Kennedy's challenge to him, the climate change debate, and other political headlines. Then we get Charlie Sennett's take on Trump's concerning phone call to Ukraine's leader, and if the one thing between us and a military conflict with Iran is the presidential election. At noon, we'll open the lines and ask you, could the Democrats have more to lose from the whistleblower scandal than the president does if they blow it?
How did Sean Spicer honor Hispanic Heritage Month? Doing the salsa on Dancing with the Stars. Bob Thompson joins us for this and a recap of the Emmys, winners and losers. And are Democrats failing the black community? Charles Barkley certainly thinks so. We'll find out on All Revved Up if Irene Monroe and Emmett Price agree. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Brown, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Did you look at my Twitter account this morning?
Oh, God, I forgot. I'm
you
sorry.
Forgot? Well, you would have learned had you done it.
Uh-huh.
Only 178 days till spring.
Oh, okay.
I would start
Thank
counting
you.
Down if I were you.
Thank you very much. Thank
well,
you very
now
much.
It is officially official. On Saturday, Joe Kennedy launched his Senate campaign, saying his focus would be on immigration reform, economic justice, and a broken political system that landed Trump in the Oval Office.
Donald Trump has forced a reckoning in our nation, without question. But to meet this moment requires more than just defeating him. It requires taking on, clearly, a broken system, the calcified structure that allowed him to win in the first place. The daily acts of oppression and injustice that enabled 63 million Americans to think that he was a better steward of their dreams and hopes and aspirations.
So if Kennedy is hoping to ride the wave of change that enabled Ayanna Pressley here and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and New York to unseat popular incumbents, does the Kennedy name and legacy give him a disadvantage when it comes to positioning himself as an insurgent? Joining us to talk about this, Trump's Ukraine problem and the Democrats, whether they'll do anything about it, and other political headlines are Steve Kerrigan, Democratic strategist and CEO of the Edward M. Kennedy Community Health Center, and Jennifer Horn, a former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. Steve, good to see you. And Jennifer, it's really good to see you. I mean, it's good to see you too. I'm sorry.
I know.
But we haven't seen Jennifer
turn.
Steve, I'm
happy to see you.
Thank you, Jen.
It is
Thank
great
you,
to see you, Jennifer.
Steve
it's
is feeling a little unloved.
That's okay.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But we
welcoming
see
you,
a
you
lot.
Back, Jennifer. Welcome
yeah,
you
exactly.
back.
Exactly. Exactly. So let's start with this whole Ukraine situation. It seems to me that we just spent 2 years in the Mueller report investigating whether the president colluded or conspired with a foreign government to help his campaign. Now it seems to me we have both the president and Rudy Giuliani admitting that they both were talking to a foreign government, Ukraine, to help his political future by dissing Joe Biden.
By the way, the day after the Mueller testimony, talking
exactly,
about...
Exactly. I was just going to say that. And the president did this the day after he realized he was going to get away. It was the day after Mueller testified. He realized, well, I got away with that. And he gets on the phone to Ukraine. I mean, it's kind of... Isn't this what we've just seen happen?
It's outrageous, isn't it? It's outrageous. Let's think about what the circumstances are here. Ukraine is not just an American ally. They're a nation, you know, that used to live behind the Iron Curtain, that had fought so hard to come forward and embrace democracy. And they're trying to move toward the Western democracy that, you know, that we would like to see Eastern Europe embrace, you know, across the board. And this president, after campaigning on, you know, against crazy conspiracy accusations along these same lines when he became president to begin with, now turns around and asks a foreign nation to tip the scales in favor of him in an American presidential election. That is outrageous. But what's really outrageous is the silence on the side of Republicans.
Yes.
Where is Mitch McConnell? Where is, you know, Governor, Senator Romney?
Well, actually, Romney right. at some points. Here's what Senator right. Romney said, and he's practically the only one. He said, if the president asked or pressured Ukraine's president to investigate his political rival, either directly or through his personal attorney, it would be troubling in the extreme, critical for the facts to come out.
Why are we saying if? Well, Trump admitted it. Giuliani admitted it.
And there's an easy way to resolve it, right? Release the transcript of the call. All those calls right. are transcribed. It's very easy. If, frankly, he should have taken that further and said, if they don't offer the proof that it wasn't a call to basically, you know, browbeat them into investigating Joe Biden, that we should start the investigation. I mean, this is egregious at its best and criminal at its worst. And I frankly think unless and until they release the transcript of that call, Congress has no choice but to frankly march down the line of obstruction of justice. It seems to be the order of the day in that administration.
Well, the anti-impeachment Speaker of the House is apparently set Thursday as the deadline. Well, she hasn't said or impeachment
right.
will start. Yeah. Ocasio-Cortez, I think, has the comment of the day on this thing. Here's her tweet. At this point, the bigger national scandal isn't the president's law-breaking behavior is the Democratic Party's refusal to impeach him for it. Clearly, the momentum is building. When you have chairs like Adam Schiff said, yeah. we may have crossed the Rubicon, and she was pretty loyal to the speaker on this. We know that she and Nadler, Pelosi and Nadler, have had a parting of the ways on this thing. And what none of the four of us have mentioned is while attempting to get help from the leader of another country in an election is bad enough in and of itself, what remains an open question is whether or not the president withheld hundreds of millions of right. dollars in foreign aid
yeah.
to Ukraine, right. which would make it, I would argue, even worse than it currently yes. is. And as Max Boot wrote in a great piece, in I think it was in the Washington Post, he said, you know, even if it wasn't explicit, a mobster doesn't have to be explicit.
Right.
What is implicit when he or he threatens is that there's a consequence, and the consequence here might have been $250 million in foreign aid. Yeah. So what do the Democrats do? I mean, the conventional wisdom is they totally blew the Lewandowski thing. Yes. We'll get to your yes. fellow New Hampshire yeah. right in a minute, Jennifer. They've blown almost everything here. What do they do with the president in this case?
So I will say that Nancy Pelosi is not one to throw out a deadline lightly in her career. She knows how to count every vote. She knows how to move around Capitol Hill better than anybody. So throwing out the deadline of Thursday, I think we'll know a lot more come Friday morning. But we are now watching a crime syndicate through the government, not just in the Ukraine call and all the other obstruction of justice stuff that was clearly laid out in the Mueller report, but time and again, members of his administration go to the Congress of the United States for oversight, which is allowed in Article 1 of the Constitution, and they just refuse to answer questions. Or they assert, Lewandowski says he wants to assert privilege when he never works in the White House.
Well, you know why they do that? Because there's no consequence.
Because they can, exactly. Well, exactly. This is enough, and the Democrats finally have to step up or get out of the way.
Here's what I don't understand about supposedly brilliant Nancy Pelosi. She should tell them, this Jerry Nadler and his minions, to stop holding these hearings in which they look ridiculous. They need to get they looked so inept. Get a lawyer. Or don't – I mean, why doesn't she tell them – I mean, I'm asking the Republican, which isn't really fair, but I'll ask you anyway, Jennifer Horne.
Why doesn't Nancy do this?
Yeah, I mean, it
well,
is –
Well, Nancy and I are like this, so go ahead. Ask your question.
But just – you have to give the Republicans credit. You know, they play hardball. They are tough. They are unrelenting. They understand. And this is going to get gaslit by the president, this whole thing. It's happening right now. Here's a Fox News headline. Joe Biden's 2020 bid likely coming to an end thanks to Clinton-linked Ukraine bombshell, Nunes says. And Nunes was the guy that got in trouble before.
Bagman.
Right.
To the president. But nonetheless, that's the Fox headline. So that's their strategy, that this is Hillary Clinton is in the woodpile here somewhere. But I guess
that is a stunning headline.
It's
coming
a stunning
from
headline.
A supposedly news organization.
Well, they lie.
Oh, yeah,
I can't believe that's their headline.
That's their headline.
You know, Jennifer, one of the reasons I'm really glad you're here today, besides the fact we haven't seen you in ages, is the question that Marjorie...
And because I'm delightful.
Well, we'll decide that
absolutely.
In a few minutes. But we talk a lot about when are the Republicans going to put country ahead of in the Senate. And I would argue the same thing about the leaders of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. But we talked about Mitt Romney, at least with a statement as compared to some of his colleagues. You resigned from the board and made national headlines not too long ago from the Log Cabin group in the Republican Party. What stops fellow Republicans. I mean, what they do is they quit, essentially. They if they can't deal with Donald Trump anymore without speaking out, they say they're not running for re-election.
Right.
Where's the disconnect?
I don't get it. I don't get it. From the beginning of this president's administration, you know, the one great light, you know, in the darkness for the Republican Party was Ben Sasse, who would at least speak up. And he wasn't argumentative. You know, he wasn't abrasive. He was just honest. He was just, you know, this is wrong. This is right. This is untrue. Why are you doing this? And he's gone silent the last several months. And we just saw recently, you know, the president sends out his tweet, Ben Sasse has my full endorsement for reelection.
Well, that's why he's gone silent.
And that's what it's all about. With all of these guys, and this is what is such a heartbreak for me as a Republican, that they have clearly made a calculated decision that they'd rather get reelected, they'd rather stay on the inside and not be attacked by this president than stand up and do what's right and say what's right. And I say this all the time. I've said it in writing. I've said it, you know, on the air. This is a weak president. Mm-hmm. He is a weak person. He is a weak politician. He's a weak president. And the fact that the entire Republican Party doesn't understand that they had the power to rein him in and keep him in line, and they could have held him accountable instead of this ridiculously destructive dynamic that has come out. As weak as he is, apparently the Republican Party is weaker.
By the way, I'm sorry to be singing the same tune I've been singing all morning. Those exact words, you could fill in Democratic Party.
Yeah.
I mean, what Nancy Pelosi is now doing is advancing this bill that would allow a sitting president to be indicted. And there are two things I'd say about it. One, the law doesn't prohibit
right.
a sitting president
from
indicting. It's a memo. That's number one. And number two, what's the argument against impeachment from Nancy Pelosi? Well, we don't have the votes in the Senate. Well, you don't have the votes
so
in
what?
The Senate
this
for
bill.
An indicting the president
but,
bill when you're doing
but it's
that.
It's kind of like, so what at this point if you don't have votes in the Senate? I would say you got to look like you're doing the right thing. And it would just be a further, which is what Jennifer Horne said, well, who even expects the Senate to vote for impeachment?
Right.
They can't vote to tell this guy, you know, to give him the least little insult. So they're never going to vote. But the Democrats stood up and did the right thing. And I think that matters to people. And by the way, when she keeps talking about following the facts, what is she talking about? They can't follow the facts because when they ask a factual question,
they obstruct.
The Republican people that are up before them tell them basically to drop dead.
Right. You think Seth Moulton's smiling this morning, Marjorie?
Yes,
again?
I think Seth Moulton is smiling this morning because she looks, I think, ridiculous.
Well, I will say, I worked in the Senate during the Clinton impeachment trial. It almost broke the nation in the end because they went through the process the right way. I think it helped at least the institutions of government involved in it. I was probably 2 months ago right where Nancy Pelosi is, like, let's not do this unless we know we can win because it'll continue to break the country. But I think at some point we have – and by the way, impeachment is a political process, not a legal one.
We know that.
And so everybody against impeachment keeps saying that. But now at this point we're being shown more and more again obstruction, law breaking, frankly, a lawless administration who – and the president and Rudy Giuliani who freely admit having talked to them about Biden and corruption. I mean, it is they're throwing it in their face, almost daring the Democrats to impeach them. And I don't know if they're doing that because they think it'll break the nation and galvanize the Republican base much more than it'll galvanize the Democrats. But I guarantee you there's some sort of calculus on her part that says impeachment's not a right move. I think for the American people at this point, if the Trump administration continues to basically be a racketeering organization and a crime family, then we have no choice but to go after
them.
Haven't
they been enough of a racketeering crime family already, Jennifer Horne?
What does it take? What does it take? I'll tell you, to your point, Marjorie, Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell are two peas in a pod in the way that they look at their responsibilities in the Congress.
Well, I don't
when
know
Nancy
about that.
When Nancy Pelosi talks about we're not going to do it because we don't have the votes, the whole idea behind this is that behind anything in Congress is that you bring it forward and you have the debate and you cast the vote and then the American people see and they hear and they know. And when it comes to this impeachment thing, I'm actually neither for nor against impeachment. I want Congress to do their job. Look at it. Do you see evidence? Do you see the
exactly where you are. Exactly
but
where you are. If you believe he has committed impeachable offenses,
fairness,
you have an obligation to act.
Well,
and if you don't, you don't.
But in fairness to Pelosi, I think that's what she means by looking at the facts. It's up to the members of the House of Representatives have that obligation to look at the facts and decide whether or not.
Looking at the facts. They're being stonewalled.
No, well, she is allowing hearings to go forward. As Speaker of the House, she could have shut that whole thing down.
They just had a hearing last week, which
I agree. It wasn't our finest moment.
Monumental embarrassment. They're going to have another one this week with McGuire, which will be another monumental.
Which is going to be another opportunity for them to do to claim privilege and do obstruction.
But the Democrats in that hearing last week with Corey Lewandowski, as far as I'm concerned, just exposed that they're as weak as the Republicans.
Exactly.
In a very different way. And somebody, I forget which columnist, somebody in one of the papers made the point that, you know, they should have, you know, called that hearing, gone to the floor and advanced.
Held them in contempt.
That's
what drives me nuts, is we always talk about holding someone in contempt and then never do anything about it.
Yeah. And his entire argument was just so false. It was built on feathers.
Is he going to be the next senator from your home state?
He's not. You know what? I absolutely hate to say this, but barring the most extraordinary of circumstances, it's likely that Senator Jeanne Shaheen is going to be the next senator of New Hampshire. Corey Lewandowski.
Who would you vote for in that race?
Who would I? In a primary?
No, in a final. If Lewandowski is the nominee.
She was just redirecting.
I could never vote for Donald Trump, and I don't see a world where I could vote for Corey Lewandowski either. And I'll tell you, this is something that I think what's happening in New Hampshire with this conversation about Corey is really something that is reflective, you know, of what's happening across the country in a lot of ways. That if Corey gets into that race, it is strictly for the purpose of raising the turnout in November 2020 of the We Love Donald Trump vote. In the state of New Hampshire, earlier this summer, the state of New Hampshire has lost 14,000 registered Republicans since 2016. So you're looking at a state.
Meaning they've become independents or Democrats?
Well, they're no longer registered Republicans. I didn't go that far. 14,000. That Donald Trump knows that. His campaign knows that. And they also know that there are states out there that they won last time that they're going to lose this time.
So they start getting
hyper-focused on places like New Hampshire. And the only purpose that Corey Lewandowski serves is not to advance our chances of winning that Senate seat, but to advance Donald Trump's chances of winning in November.
I think the Manchester Union Leader should continue its investigation into a dispute between Corey Lewandowski and his neighbor. The neighbor alleges that Lewandowski came running out of the house with a baseball bat over some dispute of some easement or something. It seems to me that all of us neighbors don't want to be attacked by our next door neighbor with a baseball bat, so maybe they should pursue that and get to the bottom of it.
That's a hell of a bumper sticker.
Can we switch parties for a second?
I am against hitting people with baseball bats, just to be clear.
Corey equals baseball bats.
We all woke up yesterday to see an Iowa poll, I think it was a CNN Des Moines Register poll, showing that Elizabeth Warren is surging. I think she's up 7 points, and essentially it's statistical dead heat, 22-20, Warren ahead of Biden, but the Warren is on the upswing. The thing, she's being criticized by fellow Democrats, by Stephen Colbert, by everybody for refusing to answer a question, particularly when she is perceived to be somebody who confronts everything head on, and I generally say that about her, whether I like a policy or not, refused to answer the question about whether middle class taxpayers are going to see the taxes go up. The answer is under Medicare for All. The answer is
yes.
They clearly are. And the thing I don't understand, I mean, I haven't done the math, but clearly her position will be one, we're going to mostly tax the rich. Yes, middle class taxes will go up, but their net out of pocket expenses will go down because they're not going to have to pay.
Right.
Why, when you don't answer a question, it's sort of like, this is a horrible analogy. I can't believe I started it. My attitude always was, it turns out I was wrong, that the reason Hillary Clinton wouldn't release the Goldman Sachs speeches because they were horrible. Turns out they weren't horrible. But the default to me always is, if you want to answer a question, the answer is a bad answer.
Yeah.
Why doesn't she just answer the damn question rather than letting this criticism build and build and build so that people are suspicious about what the real answer is?
I will say this. She has run a surprisingly disciplined campaign debacle last year. And I think their goal is to try to stay on that focus as much as possible because they are moving up in the polls. The problem is, with the spotlight comes the searchlight, right? So the more you surge to the top, more people are going to be asking this question. That question's not going away. What they need to do is come up with a non-professorial answer, due respect to the way you articulated it, to tell people what that is. Yes, of course middle-class taxes are going to go up, but the theory on Medicare for All is that your out-of-pocket health care costs are going to go down in such a way to offset the tax increase.
So why doesn't she say it? She's a pretty smart person.
Because the moment she says the middle-class taxes are going to go up, that's all you're going to hear about from July when we leave Milwaukee until Election Day in November, if she were our nominee. And she wants
she
to try to
avoid the question.
She wants
until
to try to.
Summer.
I frankly think it's a mistake to try to avoid it. I think she should come up with an answer as simple as what we just articulated and just keep saying it over and over again and try to bore people to death with it.
You know, there was an interesting little piece on Axios this morning, Mike Allen's newsletter, about a focus group, I guess, of women in Wisconsin. And, of course, the president won in Wisconsin last time around. And they were surprisingly more liberal on a lot of policies than you'd expect. But they were also really worried about a woman against the president. What do you think, Jennifer Horn? You've been looking at this stuff forever.
Sure. I think that we've seen this, you know, this president does not do well with women. And I don't mean just doesn't do well with women voters. He does not do well with having to confront women, with strong women who stand up to him, who speak up against him. He does not respond in a way that is disciplined or politically correct or productive in any way. And I think that there's a good reason why people think, gee, it would be sort of cool to see a woman run against this president. When it comes to Elizabeth Warren, however, what I would suggest, whether it's Elizabeth Warren or anybody else in that field, actually, what I think that Democratic primary voters have to really be thinking about when they're trying to decide who they're going to choose is that if they want to win, if they're looking at the Electoral College and they are being really strategic, they need a candidate who can win over the less radically left, no insult intended.
Who's that?
Disaffected Republicans, moderate Democrats,
that?
Independents. Who is that person?
Forget the polling.
I think Joe Biden. I think Amy Klobuchar. I think.
Let me counter that. I'm not sure I believe that anymore. I used to. But now I think what you need to do is you need to get a massive amount of young people, African-Americans, whom she's not doing very well, because all the excitement is with her. And I fear this mantra about, well, Joe Biden can win, is kind of like Hillary Clinton in 2016. He kind of has no reason except that he's Barack Obama's veep.
But that Obama coalition that he put together in 08 to win, what did involve a lot of new voters, did involve right. a lot of young people, didn't involve a lot of communities of color, women voters. That what we saw in 2000
did or did not
did yeah
oh did
but, that yeah, but Obama, he's not Barack Obama.
No, that's my point. But everybody keeps chasing the Obama coalition to have this great moment and can unite the nation around this. This time, Hillary tried to do it. I think what Biden is doing now is being a lot more strategic and trying to pick off the Ohios, the Michigans, the mm-hmm. Pennsylvanias to just put together 270 electoral votes.
Yeah.
And I think Elizabeth and others are trying this movement moment, right? And trying to really galvanize people and be that hope and change candidate. And that is wonderful and inspiring. But you need to get to 270 electoral votes.
But are there enough of those voters that you're talking about, Marjorie, to push her across the line? I'm not convinced that there are. And I think that we saw, you know, sort of a moving in this direction in the last Democratic debate when we saw Democrats on the stage arguing for choice in health care as opposed to mandated Medicare for all.
Well, she's going
to
back
and
off
Medicare
that. I'm convinced.
For,
she's going to back off that if she becomes
a nominee. But half of her stick, her thing, is that she doesn't back off. She tells it like it is. She's direct. She takes the argument to the field. You know, she takes the fight to the field. So I don't – what happens to her – what kind of a movement candidate is she if she starts to back off?
Yeah, and I would say the reason why – I mean, Trump voters at rallies tell you over and over again he's kept his promises, which he has in a very corrupt and horrible way, but he has kept his promises.
Mexico's paying for the wall.
Middle class tax cut, as far as he's concerned, he
can say, I cut your taxes, I'm doing something on border. I mean, we all know it's ridiculous, but he can say he's kept his promises. If on a colossal issue like healthcare, Elizabeth backs off in the general election, they're just going to hit her for flip-flopping, and it's going to be the John Kerry flip-flops.
You think a Democrat can win an election saying you're going to lose your private insurance, but trust me, Medicare for All is going to be a lot better?
I think you can with comments like Pete Buttigieg's or the vice president's, which is Medicare with a public option.
But that's not her position.
I understand that. But if the point is that she can back off or pull back a little bit on healthcare stuff, I think the moment she does that, she'll be a flip-flopper. And then that integrity piece that we need our our voters to go to the polls with sort of starts to crumble in the
Let me just say, final thought on this before we break and talk about local things. If Greta Thunberg was 19 years older and had been born in the United States, she'd be my candidate. Unfortunately, she's 16 and born in Sweden, so that's not going
to
happen.
Okay, we're talking about the latest political headlines from the Bay State to the Nation with Jennifer Horn and Steve Carrick. We're going to come back closer to the Bay State after this quick break.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking politics with the former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party, Jennifer Horn, and Democratic strategist Steve Carrigan.
Okay, at the beginning of this conversation, we heard from Joe Kennedy, who's decided he's going to run from the Senate. He's getting whacked from every corner of the Democratic Party in the state of Massachusetts, Mr. Carrigan. Why is that?
Yes. Well, not to reuse a comment I said earlier, but with the spotlight comes the searchlight. Everybody is looking at every policy that he has either – position he's either taken or not taken. People here in Massachusetts, the activists, are amped up about the – they were very excited for Elizabeth's campaign. We are always very excited. Our biggest two exports are cranberries and political hacks here in Massachusetts. And so we love election years when we can go out around the country and campaign. This is going to keep a lot of people here. It's going to cost probably $30 million to be spent on a Senate race in Massachusetts that has absolutely no impact on the balance of power. And so I think a lot of activists, although he has every right. I mean, I've known Joe a long time, and I have great respect for him. I love him. He's a friend. And I love and respect Ed. They're going to have a tough campaign. But I think a lot of people are frustrated because this dynamic is now a competition where a competition otherwise wasn't.
You know what I love about every Democrat with a position of power in the state like you? Everybody feels they have to say, I love Ed Markey and I love Joe Kennedy. You can't ever have an opinion on Joe Kennedy challenging a sitting senator of his own party. It's got to be, they're both great, great guys. So the Republicans apparently are thrilled about this for the reasons he mentioned, right?
I don't understand the question to begin with. Why is Joe Kennedy running against Ed Markey? Why not? Why shouldn't Joe Kennedy run? Why shouldn't, John Smith run? I'm not as tuned in, clearly, to the whole dynamic down here in Massachusetts. Ed Markey's been around a long time. Joe Kennedy's, a dynamic. You just talked, Marjorie, about this movement of young people going toward Elizabeth Warren. He's a dynamic young candidate. He's got some very clear ideas. Why shouldn't he run? Why shouldn't Ed Markey have to defend himself? The question, or even the argument that you just made, Steve, is very much an inside political party argument.
No doubt.
So I think those millions of voters across Massachusetts, why shouldn't they have a choice? Why shouldn't they have this debate take place?
Yeah, and the question was in answer to Marjorie asking about why the activists are all worked up. The activists are worked up because they didn't want this type of race.
If I can just interrupt seconds ago, after having sat in the UN Climate Summit for a minute or two, the president, the vice president, and their whole, not the whole delegation, but a lot of the delegation stood up and walked out of the UN.
Well, they've got to go to the faith-based thing to pray climate change away.
I'm sorry. I interrupted.
Don't mock the religious freedom meeting. I think especially when you look around the world in the Middle East, and there are a lot of – that's an incredibly important –
Did it have to be the exact same time as the climate summit?
The president just sent a very clear message to the overwhelming majority of Americans who are very concerned about climate change.
That's okay to turn your back on climate change and walk out of the room?
Right. That's alone enough of a reason for this guy to lose. I mean, if we have another 5 years of his rolling back emissions and dirtying the water.
It is amazing.
Think Elizabeth Warren can beat him?
I'm sorry, but I'm wrong all the time.
Can we go back to the nominee? Can we go back to my understanding is whatever it's called, the Democrat, I'm sure you work with them, Democratic Senatorial Committee, they support incumbents against challengers.
Yes.
So they're going to have to spend money to support Ed Markey in his challenge?
They don't necessarily have to spend money, but they have resources of staff time, polling, research, data, all that kind of stuff. And their job, just like the DCCC, is to gain and maintain a majority in their House of Congress. Okay. So they'll be spending that energy.
So they're going to have a climate change debate, if Joe Kennedy agrees to Senator Markey's invitation. And, of course, Senator Markey is with AOC on the Green New Deal.
And that's the thing. To your question, Jim, about Elizabeth and the middle class taxes, Joe, the moment Ed Markey issued that challenge, he should have said, yes, absolutely, right. I'll do it. Because then now Ed has had 3 days of saying, why haven't you agreed? Steve Pemberton has agreed. Shannon Lee Sheridan has agreed. Why haven't you agreed? What are you hiding?
This, I should have said this again. This is immediately after Joe Kennedy's entry. Senator Markey said that we should have a debate, we meaning the four of them, as early as November of this year on climate change. Can we do one more thing before you guys? Charlie Baker was with us the other day. I asked him last month why he's still a Republican and what makes him a Republican. And I frankly don't remember his answer. But we asked him the other day about the fact that the state Republican committee here, which is sort of a more Lewandowski-like Republican party than one created in Baker's image, they just passed a resolution condemning Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar and Michigan Representative Rashida Tlaib, the only two Muslim women in Congress. And here is what Governor Baker had to say.
I've tried pretty hard as a public official to stay out of what I would describe as the name-calling business. I don't really think it accomplishes very much, and I think it degrades public discourse. And while I certainly probably don't agree a lot with either of those congresswomen, they were duly elected by the people of their districts, and that's who they're accountable to. And I also think, based on something I read, that a bunch of the allegations in the the thing that the party put out were not accurate. So I don't think they should have done it. And I don't, again, I think it does exactly the wrong thing with respect to what we should be trying to do with public dialogue generally.
I would call that a respectful rebuke of your own party. Is there a place in the National Republican Party for a Baker-like character and 2020 and beyond?
Yeah, there definitely is a place for a Baker-like character. I would say that, that Governor Baker got it exactly right in his response there. And the national Republican Party nationally is desperate for a Baker-like voice right now, for someone who's willing to be a leader, who's willing to speak up, who's willing. And look at, as you said, how respectfully he pushed back on his own party there. Where's Mitch McConnell? I'm not even going to name names anymore. It's so discouraging. Every Republican senator in Washington should sound like Charlie Baker when it comes to standing up for what's right and being principled.
So I would just say, I when answering disrespect like that resolution and cloaked racism that resolution represents, I wish he had been less respectful of people who would stand up and say unsubstantiated lies about two duly elected members of Congress who, just because they were women and who happened to be Muslims, they were apparently free game. And the governor goes on radio and just gives what I thought was a little light when it came to a rebuke. I would have liked to have seen him lead. And by the way, this is the Republican Party that he runs here in Massachusetts, or he should, in theory, as the highest ranking Republican. So I'd love to. Let me be very clear. I'm grateful that he did it. I'm grateful that he does not side with Jim Lyons on almost everything.
He's the chair of the party,
on the extreme right. So I'm grateful for that. I just wish there was a little more oomph behind his rebuke.
Jennifer, we only have a minute left. Can you give us 60 seconds on what I mentioned before, the reasons for your resigning from the board of the Log Cabin Republicans?
Because Log Cabin Republicans, I was recruited to join that board, and I was honored and privileged to serve with an organization that has spent 40 years as a voice for equality in our country, for inclusion, for civil rights, for all Americans. And there is no way that that can walk side by side with an endorsement of Donald Trump, a man who has spent his entire political, his time in Washington undermining equal rights for all, dehumanizing people, pushing out, whether you're talking about, everything that he has done is about division and exclusion. And as I said in my letter of resignation, there's not a world where I can sit down and have dinner with my kids and my grandkids and explain why I endorsed Donald Trump for president. It's never going to happen. So it was difficult. I respect what that organization is about. But there was no way that I could stay there and stand with that.
Jennifer Horn, it's Jennifer good to Horn, see you. Steve
a
Kerrigan,
Republican
good to see you, too.
With principles. There we go. We need more of them.
The
Jennifer Horner is the former chair of the New Hampshire Republican. Well, it's just so beyond obvious now.
Okay,
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Keep moving.
Jennifer Horn is the former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. Steve Kerrigan is CEO of the Edward M. Kennedy Community Health Center and a Democratic strategist. Thank you both very
good
much
to see
for
you
coming
both.
In.
Thanks for
Thank
having
you.
Us.
Up next, Charlie Sennett joins us to go over the latest situation with Ukraine and Trump's questionable call with its new president. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Ginn. Response to reports that President Trump called Ukraine's president and pressured him to investigate Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. Trump defended himself on Saturday, tweeting, "The fake news media fabricated a story about me and a perfectly fine and routine conversation I had with new president of Ukraine." He said, "the Ukraine." Of course, the word routine, when it applies to Donald Trump, should not offer any kind of assurances. Yesterday, Trump made that clear when he caught up with the reporters outside the White House and suggested that during a so-called routine phone call that he did talk about VP Biden and his son.
"Conversation I had was largely congratulatory, was largely corruption, all of the corruption taking place, was largely the fact that we don't want our people like Vice President Biden and his son creating to the corruption already in the Ukraine. And Ukraine's got a lot of problems."
And Donald Trump may have a lot of problems, too. Here with us in Studio 3 to continue our discussion on this and other global headlines is Charlie Sennett. Charlie's a news analyst here at GBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hello there, Charlie.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Charlie Sennett. So I'll start with the same question I gave to our political analysts. We spent all this time on the Mueller report investigating whether or not the president or his campaign colluded or conspired with Russia to affect the election in 2016. We've just had the president of the United States and his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, admitting, both of them, that they talked to the president of Ukraine and mentioned Joe Biden, who, of course, is leading in many polls now and is the president's chief rival. So they just admitted what we just spent 2 years looking for in the Mueller report.
Yeah, allegedly, right? They want to get this report.
I don't think it's allegedly. They said it.
Well, they want to get the report from the whistleblower, right? Which seems very reasonable. And if they don't give, if the White House does not give that whistleblower report, they're going to have to answer to Nancy Pelosi. And she's been moderate. She's been measured. She's talked about it's not wise to proceed with any impeachment proceedings. But she clearly sees this as a real line in the sand for this presidency, that you're going to have to put forward that whistleblower report. If they balk at that or they fail to do it, it doesn't happen. I think he's in real, real hot water and should be.
You know, I want to move to this where Donald Trump is on this whole situation with Iran and the Saudis. Apparently, they're, according to virtually every expert, including the White House itself, the leader of Iran and the leader of the United States, even though they'll be in the same building, are not going to take that opportunity to talk to each other. There was a lot of bellicose language early on saying Iran definitely did it. We're deploying at least some troops to that part of the world. But it seems that like the latest position on the part of the president is defending the Saudis, but backing off to a degree on Iran. I'm not casting a judgment on it, but is that a fair description of where we are?
Yeah,
a week
I
or
think
so.
That is.
And what's this about that the president doesn't want to be involved in military action prior to an election, or what's going on? No, I'm serious. What's
well,
going on?
Well, I think there are probably people within the Trump administration who might even counsel him, as many presidents before have been counseled, that a simmering military conflict right before the election can be quite helpful to
the
president.
Well, except John Bolton, who was arguably the biggest advocate for that, is gone. Yeah,
but look, this is an administration in disarray on its diplomacy, and there's no time than this week that more clearly underlines that, where you have Trump administration, remember, walked away from the climate agreement. So the whole world's gathering today on climate, and the president of the United States is not at the table.
He just walked out of the meeting. We just saw him live
on CNN a couple
minutes ago. It's,
marching out.
And he's saying that he wants to instead focus on religious freedoms. This from a president who talked about banning Muslims during his campaign. This is a president whose inconsistencies and whose real missteps in diplomacy are coming home to roost this week. On climate change, the United States of America, for us not to be a leader on that, given how much of the impact of climate change we have caused, is, I think, an outrage. I think the world sees it that way, and I think we as Americans should be aware of how the world's looking at us. Similarly with Iran, I was thinking about how you got to go back and really think about this. How did the tension with Iran start? It started when this administration decided, in an extraordinary move, to rescind a signed agreement by the United States and its allies to diminish the nuclear program of Iran in order for them to come in from the cold. This had the backing of the, quote, moderates. I always put quotes around anything in Iran with the word moderate, but there are moderate forces that wanted to come in from the cold and wanted to reengage with the United States, and they were willing to diminish the nuclear program, put it back many, many years. And I've shared with your listeners and you guys so many times, there are really senior security people in Israel who think the Iran deal was a good deal for the world and Israel. It's not an accepted wisdom that that was a bad deal, as the Trump administration keeps hammering away. It was from many perspectives, from people very knowledgeable about the threat of nuclear weapons in our world, it was a really good deal, and it was a very wise deal. When he scotched that deal, he threw into disarray our relationship with Iran and in the Middle East. And you also have to think about the other factor here, which is the United States has supported Saudi Arabia through weapon sales. We do what are called petrodollars. We pay for the oil so they can buy the weapons. That's the way a lot of the oil money comes back to U.S. contractors, is through weapons deals. We give Saudi the ability to be armed to the teeth, and they have attacked a very small country, Yemen, to go after the Houthi rebels who are Shia and who are aligned with Iran. That is, by all measure, one of the worst humanitarian crises we have in the world, and there's discussion in the UN now of real war crimes being committed by both sides, by the way, but definitely by the Saudis, not to mention Khashoggi, as what I would call a pretty terrible crime against humanity, to kill a journalist and to mutilate him and to cut him up with a bone saw. Ugh. That's Saudi Arabia. That's our, quote, ally in this fight. And when you hear the Saudis say what Iran did is an act of war, well, if Yemen did it from southeastern Iraq with the help of Iran, then it is an act of war, because you're in a war. You're in a war with Yemen, a country that is desperate to survive this conflict. It is a tough and violent place, the Middle East. And right now, I can't help but think, this week in New York, in the UN, Iran is playing chess and Donald Trump is playing with matches in a region that is volatile, is too soft a word. This is a tinderbox, and you don't fool around. And the inconsistency of diplomacy we saw in North Korea can have much more hair trigger response and consequences in the Middle East.
So what exactly is our position on this thing?
What was his
position on day one? I know the day two was the strong or serious sanctions, I think. Mm-hmm. Was day one was what we're going to do? What was the president's expression? It was another in terms of locked and loaded. We were locked and loaded.
Well, now we're,
what are we now?
Okay, so now we're talking about defending our allies, Saudi Arabia. We're talking about a modest deployment of American troops, probably in the low hundreds, to go into Saudi Arabia to set up missile defense systems or to enhance existing missile defense systems. And hey, look, it's not so much that they're our ally, it's that that's where we get our oil. Let's just be clear about that. And that's not a bad thing, to have national interests. It's what happens in the world. But to think somehow that because Saudi Arabia has been attacked, that we should be dragged into a war with Iran, if they supported Yemen in carrying out those attacks, which I think it is likely they did, why should we be dragged into a war for that? This is really hard for us as Americans to understand. And I want to say this without saying I would ever be an apologist for Iran or that I think Iran has any moral equivalency with the United States. But just think of the moral mathematics here for a moment. You have the United States' support of Saudi Arabia in the barbaric war in Yemen, right?
Yep.
So we know that Iran supplies the Houthi rebels to go after, defensively, I would argue, defensively after Saudi Arabia's installations, their oil tankers around the world. They're doing whatever they can to fight a war against Iran, against the Saudis. And yes, Iran is supporting them. The United States supports Saudis through the missile defense systems that we send them and all of the attack missiles we send them that they use in Yemen, and we give them the petrodollars to go do it. Why do we think our support for Saudi Arabia in that war in Yemen is any different than Iran's support for the Houthi rebels in defending themselves against that
war
by Saudi Arabia?
It's not.
So I think we have to step back and say, look, the United States should have moral leadership and moral authority. We have to go at diplomacy first. And right now in the Middle East, particularly with Iran, totally a time for diplomacy, not for war. More of this unpredictable and irrational warmongering that comes out of this administration.
You know, I wonder if the Saudis are planning ahead. I mean, in the unlikely event we get our act together and we get off fossil fuels in 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, what happens to countries like Saudi Arabia?
It's a good question. You know, that it's almost comical to watch them plunge into renewable energy. Like, it's just like, there's something I can't help but laugh when I hear about them going after solar energy in Saudi Arabia. But they are, because they see the future coming, as does every major oil company in the world gets it, that we are going to have a better mix. That doesn't mean we're going to be off fossil fuel anytime soon. But there has to be the right mix in the world's economy with renewables and with fossil fuels. And right now the mix is wrong, and we're just sort of, you know, I was going to say we're skating on thin ice, but the ice melted long ago.
Yeah,
so whatever
no more
the whatever the metaphor is there, we're walking on the bottom in skates.
I still don't have any idea what our policy is
with relation to Iran.
I understand it. We're locked and loaded. No, we're not. We're going to impose serious sanctions. I haven't heard anybody describe what those serious sanctions are going to be.
Or how they
we have
get
a
more
very
serious.
Modest troop deployment, which I assume is so modest that it's only so we can say there's an increased deployment. And the leaders of the two countries are in the same building, and we're happy to go into North Korea to deal with one murderous dictator. That's fine. But we're not willing to sit down with a leader of Iran.
Isn't that the lesson?
By the way,
Iran, we need to be more belligerent because look at what happens with North Korea that has.
Well, but I don't know. But maybe that's right.
I think that is a logical conclusion.
But wait, was that until 2 weeks ago? Our president's position was there are no preconditions to meeting with Rouhani, the leader of Iran. Then there were. So I still don't understand what's the rationale for. I mean, you got to do something. If it's locked and loaded, I don't support that. That's one thing. If it's sanctions, it's another. If it's negotiations. But it seems to me we have chosen to do nothing.
Can't provide rationale for an administration that has none. Like, okay. This is an administration that time and time again says one thing and does another, cancels deals that many think were hard-fought diplomatic deals that took many years. Do you know how many years in the works that was between the Obama administration and Secretary of State Kerry to broker that deal with Iran to diminish their nuclear program? Again, a deal that many nuclear experts around the world think was a good deal. It's petulance.
But this
the
is
way
the danger.
It was canceled.
This is the danger too of what I would call now gaslighting that goes on. I mean, I think it's not a stretch to say that this is a lot to do with Americans for Prosperity and the brilliant campaigns the Koch brothers have run and all the money that goes into those coffers of people that oppose these things. I hate to be dumping on the Republicans because the Democrats do it too, but they've lied very effectively about the Iran deal because it was all about, oh, Obama's a weakling.
But they apparently didn't lie about Iran being responsible for the bombing of the Saudi oil fields because even John Kerry, I think, now agrees that
Iran is behind the bombing of the oil fields? Absolutely. Did Iran help the Houthi rebels execute that strike? Mm-hmm. More than likely. I'm not an expert on exactly all the forensic intelligence that's gone into those fragments of shells and how it's going to work out. All I know is it's likely that Iran was involved.
Well, again, but, why not? But, why not? Why well, not be belligerent? I just, it seems like an obvious thing.
Well, exactly.
You strangle the economy and you're getting nowhere. So let's, right. let's.
They say that war is the failure yeah. of diplomacy.
Yeah.
We are watching the failure of diplomacy careen toward conflict. And I think.
While they're increasing their nuclear
the
arsenal.
The other axiom of war is the first casualty of every war is truth. And I don't trust this administration to tell us the truth about those attacks on the oil facilities. And
that's
I definitely don't trust
elections
the
in this country, too. Hey, one last thing before I want to get to Trudeau before you leave. You reposted, I think, this yeah. Land of Cain and Abel, which for
yeah.
people who really want to understand the background yeah. for these tensions, could you briefly sum what
sure.
this, sum
I would
up
just
this
say,
thing
go,
is?
Just go to our site, thegroundtruthproject.org, and you'll see a project we've done over many years called In the Land of Cain and Abel, which tries to really look at the Sunni-Shia divide. Just to remind listeners, your listeners are really smart, so I'm sure they know this. Saudi Arabia is Sunni, and so that's part of the Sunni tradition of Islam. Iran is Shia, and that's part of the Shia tradition of Islam. Right now in the Middle East, if you want to understand most of the conflicts and wars, you really need to know the difference between the Sunni and Shia, and you need to understand that the war in Syria was a proxy war between the Sunni and Shia, that what Saudi Arabia is doing now in Yemen is a proxy war between the Saudis and Iran. And the more we involve ourselves as allied with just the Sunni on the Saudi side, and we don't understand the complexity and the hydraulics of the Middle East and the way it's a very, very complex terrain, the more we're going to stumble into poor policies in the Middle East led by failed diplomacy. And failed diplomacy, as we just said, equals war.
Okay, so, Charlie, we only have a minute left. What are your betting odds on whether or not Trudeau survives the October election?
Before I answer, don't you just love the parallels between Justin Trudeau and Trump and Pierre Trudeau and Nixon? It's like history has repeated itself. You get these sort of gnarly American presidents who get in deep hot water for corruption within their administrations, who face all these and threats of impeachment both have faced. And then you have these really handsome guys with great hair, like to the north, who challenge them on it's an amazing parallel.
But his
of
father,
history.
They just sort of got Canadians sort of got tired of him.
Exactly.
Wasn't that what it was?
And then the
I mean, this is a little worse than just getting tired, don't
well,
you
the
think?
Final the final act of comparison is that the Canadians grow very weary of the Trudeaus before Americans do. But there's nothing like the stupidity of Justin Trudeau wearing blackface when he was an adult and a thinking
teacher.
Adult, and he has every right to absolutely be taken to task over this. That said, I do think he survives. I just think he is going to be bludgeoned and worsened and weakened, and I think many of us will think a lot less of him as a world leader for having done that.
Charlie
Sennett, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. And that is where you can find this, In the Land of Cain and Abel, on the Ground Truth website. Okay. Up next, we're opening the lines and asking you, are the Democrats going to blow it on impeachment? Yes. Again, maybe not. What do you think? Is it time for Pelosi to say the I word, or does she just keep searching for the facts ad infinitum? That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Boston Public Radio, could the Democrats have more to lose from the whistleblower scandal than the president? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez thinks so. She seems to have lost her patience with some fellow Democrats tweeting, at this point, the bigger national scandal isn't the president's law-breaking behavior, it's the Democratic Party's refusal to impeach him for it. We'll open lines asking you, do you agree? And former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer has made his Dancing with the Stars debut, saying it's finally time to enjoy myself. Can the same be said for the people who watched? We'll talk to Bob Thompson about this and more.
Even though evangelicals helped to get a climate change denier into the White House, environmentalist and Christian Bill McKibben argues that it's actually the dominant theological issue of our time, and he wants our pastors advocating on behalf of the planet. On today's edition of All Wrapped Up, we talk about this and more. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Loic and Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. So if you go into Politico's homepage, page one, that is, of today's top headlines, is Trump's team is trying to stop impeachment before it starts. But what does his legal team really have to worry about? Trump's apparent request to use the Ukrainian justice system for political ends is exactly what the Democrats need to fire up their impeachment drive. And still, Nancy Pelosi can't even say the word. And as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez summed it up on Twitter, quote, "At this point, the bigger national scandal isn't the president's law-breaking behavior. It is the Democratic Party's refusal to impeach him for it." We're opening the lines asking you, is Ocasio-Cortez right? 877-301-8970. Democrats are getting tired of this inaction. Republicans, you think Trump has gone too far? Would you like to see impeachment proceedings go ahead at full steam? Or do you think exercising restraint on impeachment is the way to go? 877-301-8970. I want to be incredibly clear where I am on this thing, because I'm where Jennifer Horn is. I'm not taking the former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party, who's with us in the first hour. I'm not a pro or anti-impeachment person. I am the following. If members of the House of Representatives, and I think this includes Nancy Pelosi, believes the president of the United States, whoever he is, happens to be Donald Trump right now, has repeatedly committed impeachable offenses, high crimes and misdemeanors, they can't turn a blind eye. If this latest thing, well, it's not if it's true. He's acknowledged he spoke to the Ukrainian president.
He's acknowledged it, and so does
Rudy Giuliani. That's right.
In one of the oddest interviews, you should look it up if you haven't seen it, with Chris Cuomo on CNN.
It was great.
You know, I didn't do it.
So he did it. So they both acknowledge it happened.
They both did, yes.
And the only thing that's left, not that it's necessary, is did the president of the United States withhold foreign aid from the United States of America to encourage, as in, I would put in quotes, the president of Ukraine to do his bidding.
Which I don't I don't even think that matters that much. You know why? Because if you're the United States of America, the most powerful nation on earth, urging a small, struggling country like Ukraine to do something, the money
when
matters.
When foreign aid is pending.
Exactly. The money matters, but it doesn't matter that much.
So I guess my point is, if it turns out that you believe, one, his failure to turn over the Inspector General's report, which seemingly is mandated by law. Forget all the other breaches of the Constitution that apparently this president has engaged in. If you believe this most recent thing is a violation of the Constitution, is an impeachable offense, it seems to me if you don't proceed, even if it does cost you, even if Pelosi's right, even if it costs you in November of 2020, that you have set a precedent for presidents of the United States basically saying, as long as you are protected in the United States Senate from conviction after you're impeached, then we're never going to touch you. You can do any damn thing you choose. That's what worries me most about this, is the precedent, not legal precedent, but real world precedent this sets if the Democrats continue to be the gang that couldn't shoot straight, and they surely are the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Well, it just makes them look foolish, and they looked foolish last week with Lewandowski. They're going to look foolish again this week. I've said this a million times. They can't handle these hearings. They need to get a lawyer in there who can handle these hearings so they don't look like a bunch of grandstanders.
By the way, excuse me, they didn't need a lawyer to move on contempt for Corey Lewandowski.
No, they didn't.
Even if you think he didn't, they weren't tough enough with him.
It wasn't that they're not tough enough. they don't know how to do it. There's a couple.
Yeah, but even
of them,
if they don't know how to do it, when it was over, they, you know, one of the ironies is, you hear what Jerry Nadler's excuse is as the chair of the Judiciary Committee in the House, why they didn't immediately move to impeach, to hold him in contempt.
He said, think about it for
the
a few
rules
days.
Allegedly precluded. So the Democrats are studying the rules
they're
of the House,
the
not even the law, while the President of the United States is flipping the bird at the Constitution. They're not ready to play with this president. They really are not ready, it appears, to compete with a president who is willing to do essentially anything with impunity.
Well, you got to give him, you got to give him credit. The gaslighting is going to begin here. They're going to compare Joe Biden urging the prosecutor to be gone because other world leaders did, because there's rampant prosecution in
corruption,
Ukraine.
Rampant corruption.
Corruption, right. It is one thing to say there's rampant corruption and I'm going to join other world leaders in urging this guy to step down for the sake of Ukraine. It's another thing to say, I want you to go after the corruption of my political opponent's son. It's a totally different thing, but they're going to manage to put these two things together as they always do. Listen to this from Stephen. I think he's hit it on it, Jim. He says, the problem for Democrats is that impeachment leaves a huge carbon footprint.
Let me just say what I said at the 11 o'clock hour, and then I'll shut up, and then we can take your calls. The bankruptcy of the Pelosi position is evident in the bill that she is now supporting, as I said earlier, that would make it legal to indict a sitting president. Well, it's not illegal to indict a sitting president to begin with. It's just a missive in the Department of Justice files. But the most important point is, tell me, Marjorie, why Nancy Pelosi has suggested the Democrats should not proceed on impeachment?
Because they'll lose in the Senate.
Right. And how will they do on their indict a sitting president
they'll
bill?
They'll lose in the Senate.
Exactly. So that they can advance because it's harmless. But they can't advance what they believe is just, which is an impeachment. Again, I'm not advocating for it. I'm just saying, if you stand for something, you act on it.
You know what? Let them lose in the Senate. You'll have them on the record. You'll maybe have them smarten up and get some good lawyers in here to conduct these meetings and have more power to haul people in that don't want to come and more power to get them to ask questions. And, yeah, absolutely hold them in contempt. It would have been a great thing to hold Corey Lewandowski
on the spot
and
let
contempt.
Him challenge it.
And I'm speaking on behalf of his neighbor, whom he allegedly chased
okay,
around the yard
okay,
with a
baseball
bat.
Roger in Marblehead, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling. Hi, Roger.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to say that it struck me this morning after reading all the stuff about the Ukraine and whatnot and Trump, that Trump is the Antonio Brown of politics.
And I think
that America needs to embrace the very high moral standards that Robert Kraft has shown in his life.
And release him.
And the Patriots. And America needs to release Donald Trump.
That's very
That's
good,
a good
Roger.
One, Roger.
I like that a lot.
Roger, thank you for the call. Did you see how your good friend Dan Shaughnessy referred to Mr. Kraft, as he is called? Spineless, silent Kraft is how he wrote about him in the weekend Boston Globe. 877-301-8970. Amy in Salem.
Amy. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Hi
there.
Hi.
I guess I'm in a shrinking minority, maybe, but I called to say that I actually don't want the Senate to pursue impeachment.
Why?
I mean, I'm sorry, the House.
House.
I don't
Why?
Want the House to pursue impeachment.
Why?
Because I think that attacking Donald Trump that way, it just enhances the kind of conspiracy theory thinking on the right. And I think what the House should be doing is enacting laws on all the things that actually Americans really care about, like do a big improvement bill on Obamacare and enact laws on immigration and enact laws on education and enact laws to get us out of supporting the Saudis who are destroying Yemen.
But Amy, you realize they can't do
any
of those
things.
None of those
things will pass in the Senate.
Right.
Well, actually, they have done
a lot of those. They've done a lot of them already.
On guns. Yeah. They've done a lot.
But Amy, see, part of the problem is the air, the political air and the media air is so thick with talk of corruption. I would bet you if we stopped 100 people on the street here and listed the bills on the issues that you're mentioning that the House of Representatives already has passed, that not one person
would even know about it. That is Pelosi's strategy, with all due respect to you, Amy, is let's keep working on the business of the American people. Unfortunately, the American people don't know what they're doing because this is all Trump all the time. And it seemed, how do you respond to the note? I assume, despite your strategic position, that you, do you believe the president has committed impeachable offenses or no?
Probably, yeah.
And you're okay with, for strategic reasons, this is not an attack, by the way, this is just a question. You're okay for strategic reasons saying that they should not proceed on that, even though he's violated the Constitution. Hello?
I'm okay with that. I think the idea that impeachment is potentially an apolitical decision is just not true. It's a political decision.
I'm not saying, by the way, let me be clear here.
I'm not
saying it's apolitical at all. I agree with you and Pelosi. It could have negative consequences for the Democratic Party, but I think there are certain times you have to act on your beliefs regardless of what the consequences are. But I respect your opinion. And by the way, your opinion is held by, I think, the highest-ranking Democrat in Washington, Nancy Pelosi. Amy, thank you for the call.
You also say to yourself, okay, we held impeachment hearings involving Bill Clinton, who lied about sex. We had impeachment hearings against Richard Nixon, who lied about a break-in lied about a secret enemies list, and then wouldn't hand over the 18-minute mystery tape that had people talking about how he and Haldeman and Ehrlichman knew about all this stuff in the House. And then you look at what this guy has done, you know, that he's making money without question from the American taxpayer for his hotels, that he obstructed justice over and over and over again and was only prevented from obstructing it further by his own minions, mainly Don McGahn, the guy that they can't get, Democrats can't get before them in the House.
How about obstructing the ability of Congress to do its job?
Absolutely.
And investigate?
What was that Lewandowski thing last week? Just one long stonewall and obstruction. He kept saying, president told me I can't talk about this. Well, the president has no right to tell him not to talk about this. He wasn't an employee of the White House. He was whatever he became, a consultant or whatever he did after that, making all the money after he took you and showed you how you could see the president's bedroom from his office. It was just a...
He was actually very polite.
It was like
in
a
that
big
interview.
Drop dead to the American people. And as Joe Biden has said, America is an idea, you know, and how long have we talked about the rule of law in the United States? So if you just have somebody that says, drop dead to all the laws, it's really, I mean, look at what this man has managed to do by being like the Roy Cohn president. It's incredible.
877-301-8970. We're talking about, obviously, this whole thing with the whistleblower and whether or not the Democrats in Congress have any idea what they're doing. You know, by the way, if they were unified, if you remember the incredible moment last week, remember in the Democratic caucus when Nancy Pelosi was critical of Jerry Nadler, her Judiciary Committee chair, for calling the proceedings impeachment proceedings, and she said to the Democrats in the room, feel free to leak this to the press. You know, in addition to and everything else, there's absolutely no unity, which furthers the notion with the voter, I believe, that this is a party that has no idea what it is doing and has absolutely no idea how to confront the president of the United States' lawlessness where it is.
Tim in Portsmouth, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tim.
Good afternoon, folks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, God bless your congressman, Seth Moulton. He is a very prescient dude. He had it right a couple years ago when he moved to remove Nancy Pelosi from her leadership position. I can only hope that somebody else in the Congress has enough courage to do it again, because Nancy Pelosi is in a job that she can't do. It's beyond her capabilities. In fact, I'm beginning to wonder if it's beyond the capabilities. I agree with Marjorie. It may be beyond the capabilities of the Democratic Party. But just picture this as a scenario. What if we had impeached the president and brought him impeachment proceedings full force in the real thing 3 months ago, and now we hear about this attempted abuse of power in Ukraine, and he's already under impeachment. It would have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Now it's like the failure of Nancy Pelosi amplified 77 times. I want to close with this. What happened in 2010? What happened to the House of Representatives that Obama seed won in 2008, 2010? Nancy Pelosi lost the House of Representatives. In 2012, Barack Obama cruised to re-election. What did Nancy Pelosi do in the House of Representatives? She went 8 long years in the desert. And people say she's a political genius. You could have fooled me.
Well, Tim, I have to say, with current events, I'm with you. I think your history needs a little revision. Most objective people say there would not be a universal health care law, even though it's not quite universal, without Nancy Pelosi. People think she was as strong as any leader on issues like the war. So I would agree with you. I don't like her strategy now, but to discount what she has done in the past, which I never have, I think is wrong. But Tim, thank you much for the call. And I agree. I said it this morning. I think Moulton is probably smiling somewhere up on the North Shore. Because I think there's a growing feeling within the Democratic Party in Congress and beyond that Nancy Pelosi has blown this.
Our number is 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org. We're talking about whether it is time to impeach the president, whether the Democrats are botching this from beginning to end. Pelosi's also said, of course, that she's concerned about the Democrats who won seats in the House in Trump districts.
Sure.
That impeachment will so aggravate people that they will be thrown out. And I don't know. Maybe that's true. But
well, let them vote against it if that's their position.
Well, it would be great to get people on the record. I really think it'd be wonderful to get people on the record. And the second thing is, and it's a different time, I get it, that we did not have a Fox News there distorting everything. This is their headline about this, about Ukraine. Biden's 2020 bid unlikely, Biden's 2020 bid likely coming to an end thanks to Clinton-linked Ukraine bombshell, says Devin Nunes, who's the Republican that's been one of the president's staunchest defiant.
Former head of the intelligence committee,
yeah,
remember?
That's what the headline is. So, but again, I don't know if that's the right way to think of it anymore, that we can't, because the Senate's going to vote against it and because people in these Trump districts might lose their seats. I don't know.
How do people live with themselves? When there is an issue that that reaches moral proportions, how do you decide to vote against your conscience and speak against your conscience purely to keep a job? By the way, these are not some low wage workers who, for the most part, are never going to be able to find further employment. Every single member of Congress, should they be voted out, if they lost their seat, probably make 10 times more as a lobbyist in Washington or back in their home state. So it isn't like a low-wage worker who puts him or herself at risk, who then puts their family at risk because they won't have any income or employment. It is pathetic. It is pathetic.
Well,
We
were just talking to Jennifer Horn about, who's a Republican strategist, about how she resigned from the board of the Log Cabin Republicans. The Log Cabin Republicans have been big champions of the Republican Party, gay rights, mostly gay men. I guess there are gay women too, but I think of them more as gay men. I could be wrong. There's more gay men than gay women on there. But in any case, they have endorsed the president. Now you say to yourself, how do they arrive at that decision? The Log Cabin Republicans, the president has not been good on gay rights, even though he said he was going to be when he came in. So where does that come from?
Where does Lindsey Graham come from? The head of the Foreign Relations Committee, whose best friend in his lifetime was John McCain, who both thought this president was without principle, but who's been savaged by this president, even in death.
Well,
What's his deal?
Answer is that the Republican Party has become a subsidiary of Donald Trump's presidency, and he has an approval ratings of 80% to 90%. So therefore, it's too dangerous for you to criticize the president. It's about getting reelected, I guess, and that's what they think is the best way to go.
Gail and Sharon, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Gail.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My biggest concern is that Donald Trump makes this call right after everything's okay with the Mueller report.
Right.
Day after.
And this is going to be an ongoing digging. He doesn't care what country he goes to, what blackmail he has to use in order to get information about Biden or anyone else, and that our vote and our election will be worthless if he is allowed to continue in this direction. Originally, I thought, well, Nancy Pelosi, she's being strategic, weighing things. They dragged the feet so much that, you know, the waters got muddy. This one, she needs to go after it immediately, and she needs to call the people in, and when they sit there and refuse to answer, she needs to have the authorities right there to lock them up.
You know, don't go away, Gail. That's what would Nancy Pelosi say if she were listening to Gail's call? Is when you allow, if you don't act on this abuse, the requests of the Ukrainian president, why should the American people believe the president will not use the same tactics
the
with anybody, any foreign leader who can help him in his election?
It's like the bully theory, Gail, right? If a bully keeps mm-hmm. getting away with it, he keeps doing it and over and over. And I think that the president has very smartly realized that the Democrats are toothless, that they're not going to do anything about it. Notice he gives nicknames to everybody. He's not giving nicknames to Nancy Pelosi. And one of the theories is that because Nancy Pelosi told him mm-hmm. early on she wasn't going to impeach him. And so he says nice things about Nancy, Nancy, Nancy. But I think it's absolutely true that it will just continue. I mean, it will be, by the way, we should point out, I think it was not, Hunter Biden did not do his father's any favors by going on the board of this Ukraine oil company. He shouldn't have done that. And that is going to enable the Trump supporters to gaslight this and make them seem like they're the equivalent thing, which they are not. But unfortunately, he did do that. But I think you're right, Gail. I don't know what Nancy Pelosi would say, but I think at this point she looks ridiculous.
Gail, thank you very much for the call. 877-301-8970. Bernier in Hyde Park, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Bernier.
Good morning, guys. Hi. Once again, thank you for the show.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Thanks.
But, Jim, I have two things. First of all, I have a problem with you that do not want to move to the light. I mean, you're saying you don't know if you're for impeachment, if you're not for it. I'm like, okay, is it a strategic thing, Nancy Pelosi, that you're not?
No, my position is that's not why I'm here. I am here to try to help facilitate a conversation. I'm not here to tell people who I'm voting for or say whether I'm for or against impeachment. It's just how I view my responsibility here. It's not about how I feel in life. I'm not going to tell you who I voted for in every election, even though it might be clear in many.
Bernier, I'll tell you this. I will not be voting for President Trump.
But that's where it is. But your criticism is, I take it to heart. Thank you. What's your other point?
Okay. The other point is that I am so upset. You guys have no idea. I feel like I need to drink something. Because I said this months ago. The Democrats' strategy should be very clear. You do your job, as Jim said. Okay, you have a constitutional responsibility to supervise, if you will, or to oversee what the president is doing. And if he commits crime, you need to do that. Don't worry about what the Senate is going to do. But politically speaking, if you do that, you're going to put the Republicans and the Senate on notice, and you could run against those people. And take your chance. You might win the Senate and the presidency that way. But the Democrats have this coward gene. I don't know. There's a gene of cowardice, that the Democrats have. I don't know where they get that from.
I think I agree with virtually every word you said after your criticism of me, of course, Bernier. I don't think they have a strategy. I don't think they know. And Marjorie said it in the first hour. The Republicans for years and years have been a take-no-prisoners kind of relentless attack on the opposition. And the Democrats play by another set of rules that don't allow you to win.
They're looking in the rule book.
Well, maybe they are, while the others are ripping up the rule book. Bernier, as always, thanks for your call.
I'm not to say there shouldn't be an adherence to the rules, but this isn't about rules because, as we've said a million times, an impeachment is a political decision. And it seems to me that there's more than enough. There was in the Mueller report. There was in making money off your hotels. I think that if one of the president's main obligations is to protect the citizens of the United States of America, he's failing on that because the whole world knows that climate change is an emergency and a crisis. And he is like telling us all, hey, too bad. I don't care. I'm going to make the water dirtier. I'm going to make the air less clean. I'm not going to pay attention to any of this stuff. I think it's a hoax from China. I mean,
you know how brazen. You know, you've said this a couple times, and I have too. But just to pause for a second to show how brazen this man is, the day after Mueller
is done his testimony, the day after he's done his testimony, and it's clear that Mueller, I mean, I'm sorry, I know people are offended by this, was not up to the job of at least public testimony. You could question whether the report said what it should have said. The day after is the day, July 25th, he's on the phone with the president of Ukraine having this collusion conversation.
Think of the bullies you knew in school. If on Monday the bully gets out and beats up three kids and the teachers and the principal do nothing about it and half the school cheers for him, then what does he do the next day?
He
goes out and beats up the next kid. It's almost like the Democrats are giving him permission to just keep going on and on and on.
I agree with that.
And the question about if he's going after Ukraine to help him in his election. And again, this is what the Mueller report was all about, right? Finding out whether the president colluded or conspired with Russia to help his election. Now we've just had the president admit he did. Essentially, he has admitted it. And Rudy Giuliani has admitted it. He did do with just a different country, Ukraine. So I guess I don't understand if we spent 2 years trying to find out about the Mueller report, through the Mueller report, and he's done our work for us, admitting it. Isn't that kind of a jigs up moment?
Bob in Amherst, New Hampshire. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. I just want to say that if there is an impeachment hearing, that the senators themselves will be on trial. Because the American people know what's right and what's wrong.
Well, I tend to agree with you, but Nancy, I don't mean
some of them don't because they are ardent supporters of the president.
Yeah, but Nancy Pelosi also doesn't agree with you and me because I agree it would totally turn the attention to them, and I would assume that if the Democrats did their job well, it would accrue to the benefit of Democrats running for the Senate. But apparently, Nancy Pelosi, who was more experienced than both of us, disagrees, Bob. Bob, thank you very much for the call. And by the way, again, CNN is reporting this morning that the White House is considering releasing the transcript of the phone conversation. I don't know what that means or what will happen. And that Nancy Pelosi has set some sort of a deadline. She hasn't said what happens if the deadline is not met.
Well, we'll go
some
back.
Sort of a deadline
Here's
of
what
Thursday.
We'll do. When the deadline is not met, we'll go back to following the facts. We'll go back to searching out the facts.
Is that the expression she's using?
It's something like that. Okay. It's got facts in there. Where the lead us, let follow the facts, or let the facts lead us, or whatever. And I would argue that the facts aren't leading you very far because the people that could give you the facts are basically telling you to go take a hike. Anyway, coming up, Bob Thompson joins us to recap the Emmys and more. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie. And it's fitting that former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer is on the new season of Dancing with the Stars, considering the average amount of time a contestant lasts on the show is roughly equivalent to how long a staffer lasts in Trump's White House. But that's where the parallels end. It turns out Spicer's Dancing with the Stars debut was a ratings flop compared to Donald Trump's presidential debut, which, as I'm sure you recall, yielded the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period. Joining us on the line to talk about this, the Emmy Awards, and other TV news is Bob Thompson. Bob's a professor and founding director of the Live Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello there, Bob Thompson.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. Very excited to talk to you today for a bunch of reasons, but let's start with your worst.
Well, my worst is Sean Spicer's appearance on Dancing with the Star. And let's get away from the fact that they kind of legitimized this person who really trafficked in political deception. Let's get away from all of the fact that he didn't dance very well, although I should talk. Let's get away from his outfit. Mike Huckabee tweeted the day after that he wanted to get everybody out there to go against Holly Weird, as he called it, and make sure that Sean Spicer won this whole thing. And then Sean Spicer tweeted back, and this has been deleted, so you can't see it anymore. The most mysteriously strange tweet: thank you, @Governor Mike Huckabee. Clearly the judges aren't going to be with me. Let's send a message to #Hollywood that those of us who stand for #Christ won't be discounted.
No.
May God bless you.
I didn't know about
this. Oh, yeah. Really weird.
Okay, so I, for one thing, I don't know where to start about this. What it immediately makes me think is, what if biblical characters could be on Dancing with the Stars? Now, I don't think hashtag Christ would have done it, although he would have won. I've seen Godspell. But then all of a sudden, I think, who would have been the best biblical character for Dancing with the Stars? And I thought about this for a long time, and I came up with an answer. Do you want to know what it is?
Of course we do.
Bathsheba.
Bathsheba. I knew you were going to say that. Naked in the bathtub.
She didn't last very long in the book, but she made a big impression.
She did.
So she was kind of a B-star, but important. She's conventionally beautiful. She caused a lot of trouble.
Yep.
She would have been a tasteless choice. She'd be perfect for Dancing with the Stars.
So obviously you two want to discuss that aspect. I want to discuss the attire. Here is Sean Spicer in an interview following his salsa performance, describing the difference between Dancing with the Stars and working in the White House.
I never wore lime green once. I usually wear a tie, so there was no open shirts. It's an entirely different thing. One is real cerebral, where you're cramming information and trying to get it back out on message. This is clearly a different physical, rhythmic kind of thing that's not what I was used to.
Well, he's not clever either, so that's about nine strikes.
It wasn't to me so much the color. It was like the
ruffles.
The ruffles on the sleeves. I wasn't sure where they were going with that.
I wore that same shirt to my senior prom, actually, in high school. I did.
Someone compared it to Big Bird. By the way, he didn't get the lowest judge's rating. Lamar Odom got that. He was second to last. And they don't vote anybody off on the first night. So if you want to see Sean Spicer dance again tonight, you will have that opportunity.
My goodness.
By the way, I thought it was disgraceful, your first point that he was on to begin with. But then I didn't know about that tweet. That is just incredible. So what was your best there, Bob Thompson?
I think I'm going to give my best to Between Two Ferns, the movie.
Ooh.
Now, we've talked about Between Two Ferns before.
Yep.
Back in, 5 years ago, Barack Obama That's appeared great. On that as a great. Sitting president to encourage young people to sign up for his health care program. And it's this deliberately dumb kind of Wayne's World-like, supposed to look like a public access a television show, and he interviews people, and he's really inappropriate with them. Zach Galifianakis, that is. But this is a scripted narrative movie that was introduced by Netflix on Friday. It's not getting great reviews, but I watched it when it came out on Friday, and the more I think about it, the more I like it.
We get a clip. We have a little clip to get people in the mood here from the brand new, as Bob was just talking about, Between Two Ferns movie. It's on Netflix.
It's a good show. Right now, it's the seventh-ranked show in southeastern North Carolina's public access television market. I mean, do I have other dreams? Ultimately in life, I'd like to have my own late-night talk show. But this, for now, what I have now, this'll do.
Welcome to another edition of Between Two Ferns. I'm your host, Zach Galifianakis, and today my guest is Matthew McConaughey. Matthew McConaughey.
Good to be here, Zach.
All right. Sorry, I was just reading the box office returns for your last three movies.
They say that the end of it, which has the outtakes, is terrific.
Everybody
is that so?
Laughing, yeah.
Yes, it's like the last episode of Veep. You've got to watch it through the credits. By the way, they kill Matthew McConaughey within the first 15 minutes of the thing, but he gets brought back to life, so no need to worry. In a plumbing accident, the likes of which I've never seen on television before. And Keanu Reeves, Paul Rudd, Chrissy Teigen, John Legend, they have 12 or 13 people come on this. And for all of its deliberate stupidity, and it is very deliberate, it ends up being a very sweet little show. It reminds me of, you remember the Gong Show movie? Every critic totally panned the Gong Show movie, but I still think the Gong Show movie was one of the most brilliantly absurd films to ever come out, and this kind of reminded me of that.
I remember when I saw the Gong Show movie, I tweeted out, hashtag Christ would love this rendition of the, but I deleted it immediately, by the way.
So Bob,
that's amazing that you were able to do that when there was no hashtags or tweeting.
Exactly.
But,
well, I was, he was a man
but
ahead
Jim
of his
Brody,
time.
You can do anything
that's
you
right.
want to do.
Man
that's
ahead
right.
of my time.
So Bob Thompson, our TV guy, speaking of Veep, Veep kind of got bested in the Emmys. Tell us what happened.
It did, although Veep shouldn't complain. It's been it's gotten plenty Emmys, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus has got needs a separate apartment to hold her Emmys. But the big big story, of course, was Best Comedy Series went to Fleabag, yeah. which we talked about not that many weeks ago. By the way, nearly every show that won an Emmy, we have at some point put as our best or as our what to watch, with a couple of exceptions. A Very English Scandal we haven't talked about, and Succession, which I'm going to correct. We're going to talk about that at some point. But other than that, these are all shows. These Emmy Awards were old news if you've been listening to Boston Public Radio.
So let me, I have to say, I'm
go.
Fine with the note.
We're ahead of our time here, Jim.
Well, I think he is ahead of his time. We surely are not. So, Bob, I was okay with the no-host thing, in part because I've spoken to you about it repeatedly. Who was this loser doing commentary on the side of the stage throughout the night? Who was this character?
Okay, I wasn't going to bring that up. Thomas Lennon.
Oh, my God.
But it was like the really annoying person in the room when you're watching television that you wish would just go home or fall asleep, making snarky comments, some of them borderline tasteless. And I think they were trying to make the Emmys hip. And I put that in about six sets of quotation marks. I don't think it worked. I don't think it will come back again. Yes, I agree with you that that was really annoying. Although it was just filling time as people walked up on the stage. So I guess you could kind of put your fingers in your ears and make noises with your tongue until the speeches started.
You know, I only watched one last thing about
that. By the way, it started with the host. Homer Simpson was the host.
Well, speaking of
And then he got...
Good.
He got a piano dropped on him, which was kind of a really obscure reference to the end of Two and a Half Men, the final episode in which Charlie Sheen from behind, because he wasn't in it anymore, had a piano dropped on him. And then Chuck Lorre, the creator of the show, had a piano dropped on him. And then the show ended. That would have been funny a few years ago. I'm not sure how funny it was last night.
Well, speaking of obscure, I didn't even know that was the reference. But I only watched half of it last night. I watched a lot more this morning when I woke up. The Family Guy thing was pretty edgy with them talking about all the awards that Cosby and Roseanne had won in the past, ending with, so I wonder who will be this year's Cosby or Roseanne. That is pretty edgy for the Emmys, is it not?
Yeah, I thought that was, and there were a couple of moments like that, but yes, I thought that was a fairly insightful. They made a reference to Felicity Huffman as well, talking about
2 weeks.
You know, hopefully
Desperate
in 2 weeks we'll go back. Exactly.
Yeah.
But the upshot of the Emmys is just when you read the list of these nominations, forget who won. There are just so many good shows out
That's
there.
Exactly
I mean,
right.
Every one of those nominees 30 years ago would have been considered the greatest thing that ever happened on television. And they made a little too much of that. The head of the Academy or whoever he is who comes out there came out and said, thank you to you all, not only for watching, but for watching television. I mean, there were some typical ham-handed moments on this, but...
Okay.
But a lot of people who had never heard of Fleabag now have heard of Fleabag. So
yeah,
that's
it's a British. My kids were talking about it this weekend. It's a British.
Great.
It's a young British woman and her travails. Basically, gives
right.
us a,
got very little attention here in its first season, but in its second season, needless to say, it got a lot. We talked about it a few weeks ago. Again, it's not something you want to snuggle up with the 9-year-olds and watch. It is a really exquisitely written thing, and it got 4 major Emmys last night.
And Phoebe, what's her name, is fabulous. But she is really, really, really
talented. We're talking to Bob Thompson, our
TV guy. Waller-Bridge, right, and she was recognized as lead actress in a comedy.
Yep.
So, Bob Thompson, our TV guy, a lot of streaming news involving the great shows, including The Office, Big Bang Theory, Seinfeld, and Friends. What's going on?
Yeah, well, again, and we brought this up before, but for all the talk we do about Chernobyl and Fleabag and all of these great kinds of things, in the end, the real audiences and the real power are in old-fashioned network sitcoms. Netflix just paid $500 million for the Seinfeld Art Archive. HBO Max committed $425 million to steal Friends from The Office. And anywhere from $600 million to $1 billion, depending on which reports you did, to get The Big Bang Theory. So anybody who says the old-fashioned sitcom is dead, it may be dead to the tune of $1 billion. And then NBC Universal's upcoming Peacock service, their own online streaming service that's going to start in the spring, paid $500 million to steal The Office from Netflix. And then there's also talk, although it's in the very, very early stages, of rebooting The Office, although I'll believe that when I see it.
By the way, who watches these this streaming stuff of shows that were huge 20 years ago? What's the demographic of the audience? Because I always thought that the money is spent on the next generation of viewers, millennials and those sort of people, and so much of this humor is so dated.
I don't know. I think the in my house, The Office with millennials Office is huge.
Big Bang Theory. I know I've said this every time it's ever come up. One of the least funny shows. I know one of the most successful ever. But who's the audience for this?
Well, that's one of the keys to this, that the audience spreads across the entire demographic spectrum, and it includes these young folks. If I mention Chernobyl to 100 of my students who are 20, 21 years old, 30 of them might have seen it. 20 of them might have seen it. If I mention Friends to them, 80 of them have seen an episode of Friends within the last 24 hours. Tomorrow at our my famous Tuesday lunches that I show in my outer office, I'm going to show the entire NBC lineup from 25 years ago, September 22nd, 1994, which includes the first episode of Friends. Mm. And I'll have more people showing up for that than the rest of the semester.
Well, it makes sense, though.
Why
I mean,
is that?
Because even though Friends is dated and the technology is different and all that kind of stuff, it's the kind of stuff that people in that age group, you know, there's a similarities, I think, of
but why wouldn't they prefer contemporary version of that?
What is the contemporary version of that? I mean, I thought that was, if you like that kind of thing, it was a terrific show. And the same thing with Seinfeld. You know what I mean? Seinfeld is just, I think, Bob, you know better than I do, but just still really funny if you're 20 or if you're 75.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. They were really well written and really well performed, even though there's a lot of offensive stuff in all of them, which we've talked about before. But one of the other theories is that Friends is that last moment where people, and we talked about this last week, where people who are friends actually are in the same physical space with one another.
Okay.
There are no cell phones in Friends. There's no smartphones. There's none of that. And there is something, and again, I'm repeating myself, but there's something charmingly quaint about the fact that when you wanted to talk to one of your friends, you went into their apartment and you talked to them.
Right.
When you liked a friend, you actually liked them as opposed
to
push the like button.
Yeah. And Seinfeld to a certain degree, too, right? Remember Michael, what's his name, was always barging into the door to Jerry's apartment.
Yeah,
they
nobody liked anybody on Seinfeld. But yeah, there was that as well. You're right. Then they had those big cell phones where you had to pull the antenna out before you could talk, or big wireless phones.
And they were always having lunch at the diner.
So speaking of...
Right, like human beings once did with one another.
Speaking of bringing something back from another era, I have to say, if I am amazed that Hogan's Heroes, considering the timing of the original, was a success. But it's coming back in a... I don't quite understand how you update something about concentration camps from World War II.
Isn't that amazing? We were so close to World War II when it started.
So what are they doing exactly?
Yeah, don't get me started on this too far. But, yes, I remember I was on the Today Show one morning, and I was discussing the new shows of the fall season. There was this show called Chains of Love. It was a dating show where a guy got chained, literally chained, to five women, and each night he would decide which one to let go.
That was on the S&M Network, wasn't it? Thank you.
So you and I have talked. That was one of your favorite shows, if I'm not recalled.
Jake keeps bringing that up.
I tried out, but I don't know what to make of it. Go ahead. Next.
But anyway, I remember telling Katie Couric I thought this was the worst idea for a TV show since Hogan's Heroes. And Katie Couric went off on me for a minute and a half about what a wonderful show Hogan's Heroes was. And then later that night, I was on MSNBC talking about something else entirely. And at the end of the interview, the guy said, by the way, I heard you saying bad things about Hogan's Heroes on the Today Show this morning. What's your problem? That was a great show. This was a show, as you pointed out, set in a Nazi prisoner of war camp. And it was madcap, laugh track kind of thing. It was a funny show, but it was a really bad idea. So, it started in 1965, which is what? Only 20 years after the end of the Second World War.
Right.
So they're bringing it back now, and it's some big shots involved in bringing it back. This isn't just some small little petty operation. However, we should point out that it's going to be set in the present time. It's going to be about the descendants of the prisoners in Hogan's Heroes, and they're going to be on some international treasure hunt, as they describe it. So who knows? They might try to redeem the old franchise with this, but I don't know. It doesn't sound like a good idea to me.
By the way, and it wasn't the star, Bob, whatever his name was, wasn't he like brutally murdered or something?
Yeah,
and
was.
They never solved the murder?
They made a movie about that.
They did?
A very disturbing movie about that. I forget the title of it. Oh. But yes, that was that was quite a scandal.
But you know, I vaguely remember watching this program, and I thought
Hogan's Heroes.
What made it hysterical is that the guy who played Commandant Klink and Sergeant Schultz were just so funny. I mean, so I don't know how it just worked. I don't know how you recreate that in the same way. You know, they're gone.
Well, it did work, and that's I think that was one of the problems, was that it made the people who ran prisoner of war camps in World War II Germany kind of lovable buffoons. A lot of people had that problem with All in the Family, that Archie Bunker was a teddy bear of a bigot.
So what's in my mind as you're speaking, Springtime for Hitler. Now, I have
the
producers stuck in my head, which was
well,
fabulous.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I shouldn't categorically say that this subject matter is incapable of being treated
by
comedians.
With you.
Of course, that's not true. And the producers, what? A movie, a Broadway play, another movie based on the Broadway play, based on the movie. I mean, that show continues. So, and Hogan's Heroes, I don't know. I just think a sitcom with Nazis. I show an episode of that in my history of television class. And the good guys, Hogan's people, are masquerading as Nazis for some one scheme or another. I think they're trying to get more booze delivered to the camp. And the words Heil Hitler are uttered 18 times in 3 minutes. And the laugh track is going nuts over this. I don't know. That just seems really weird in 1965. It seems just as weird in 2019.
Okay, so we won't be watching that. What are we watching, Bob Thompson?
Criminal, which also Netflix introduced on Friday, and this sounds like it would be unwatchable. It's four different series, one of them in German, one of them in Spanish, one of them in French, and one of them from the UK, so it's in English. And each one is three episodes, and each of the three episodes has a different cast. And essentially, it's about an interrogation room. The entire episode takes place in the interrogation room. The people in the room that are looking through the one-way glass into the interrogation room, and a little bit in the vending machines where they take the break. This is not the first time this has happened. Homicide won an Emmy back in the early 90s for a show that took place almost exclusively in an interrogation room. But it's a real challenge that this is a very theatrical idea, that it's all about dialogue. It's all about language. And I've watched a couple of the French ones and all of the UK ones, and I find them really, really compelling.
I can't wait.
Okay, we get a clip from this criminal UK, which opens on Dr. Edgar Fallon, played by David Tennant, and he's being interrogated.
But you don't lose your temper.
No comment.
No comments all the way. What's your feeling? You did it.
Tony's doing the big trick. The innocent tend to jump, shout, protest.
Not always, but carry on.
Well, the more active. The grab, point, fidget and what have you. The biro on the table. It's been sat there for 2 hours and Fallon hasn't touched it once. Do they not try things like that in West Midlands police, then?
Well, they're old-fashioned, aren't they? They tend to want evidence.
I'll tell you, it sounds fabulous. And I'm a huge fan of his, too. I mean, a huge fan.
And here's the other thing, how they showed off. David Tennant, of course, Doctor Who, great Shakespearean actor. For the first 18 minutes of that episode, close to half of the episode, he says only 2 words in his dialogue, which is no comment. And he says it about 100 different times. And I swear, watching David Tennant in a scene like that, saying no comment 100 times is way more compelling than most other actors saying all kinds of other fancy stuff.
By the way, don't leave out, he was in Broadchurch, too, and was brilliant in Broadchurch.
Oh, that's right.
That's
no, he was
where
in so
I
many
recognized
great.
Him
He's
from.
Great. He's great.
He was the cop, wasn't
but,
he?
Yeah, I cannot wait to see this. Bob, it's great to talk to you, as always. Thanks so much.
Bob, thank you.
Always fun. Thank you, guys.
Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founder and director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Up next, time for All Revved Up with Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. They're next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day are Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett G. Price III. They join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist. Emmett is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Black Christian Experience, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. They're also the hosts of the All Revved Up podcast, which premiered last Wednesday, meaning the most recent edition. To learn more about it and to subscribe, go to allrevvedup.org. And this Wednesday, you can catch Irene at the Cambridge Public Library main branch, 6 to 8:30, for a dialogue on women's voting rights. And on Thursday, Irene will be receiving an award as one of Boston's 25 most influential LGBTQ people of color. That's 5:30 to 8 at Tufts Health Plan in Watertown. Congratulations, Irene Monroe.
Yeah, congratulations. That's fantastic.
Congratulations. Thank you. Happy first day of fall. I love a day like today.
I know. It's like 90 degrees out, right?
Isn't it? It's wonderful. It's delicious and golden.
So the Catholic Church seems never to learn. Now we have another story from this summer about this Bristol, Rhode Island Reverend Barry Gamache, who apparently knew for 2 decades that there was a multiply accused predator on the staff, a guy named Barboza, who since resigned. Not only did he know, but apparently both bishops down there, Bishop Robert E. Mulvey and Bishop Tobin, we last heard about him when he was telling people not to go to the gay pride events because it might be harmful to children. Apparently they knew as well. And this Gamache appears to have lied to the Boston Globe, saying he didn't know anything about this, but he did because some of the victims came forward themselves.
By the way, he said he didn't know anything about it until they showed him documentation.
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly.
And then he had to admit that he knew something about it.
So I guess it just never
ends.
Well, it will end. It will end.
I think the challenge is that we're still uncovering. I mean, even with all the spotlight investigations across the nation, even with a number of courageous parishioners taking over their parishes, we're still finding out these situations, and they're absolutely disturbing. They're haunting. And when you read the chronicle of at least one young person who was an Eagle Scout,
yeah.
who, I mean, it's just yeah. absolutely horrific.
Pulls at your
heartstrings. The people in charge, the diocese, would allow for this level of lack of, you know,
accountability.
Well, also, what the heck are they thinking in 2019? Are they not going to get away with this?
Well, they're not.
Going to find out.
Yeah. Well, they're not. See, this is Emmett is the eternal like optimist. I'm not optimistic about it. I don't think it will end until you change doctrine. I don't think that when you have the perpetrators and enablers, of this crisis to police themselves, that they can do that. I think that when you have you have gotten rid of or you have discarded these records of all these sex abuse cases that have just been. For some reason, have disappeared. You can't hold them accountable. I think when you still have on the book a no snitch policy that you will change. And I think that what we got.
I think there is a snitch.
There is
we're supposed to snitch
yeah,
now.
We,
there's
we
no
are.
No
yeah.
snitch.
Yeah, we
no
changed
snitch
that.
They changed. Well, okay. Then there's one of many that they need to change. And I think that we got to really understand this. We got to own up, like we did with the Me Too movement, that this is really a rape culture that is going unaddressed for a whole lot of reasons. And I think that there's an arrested, psychosexual as well as social development of these seminarians who become priests. There has to be a kind of really robust kind of intervention, and nothing is happening.
Can I tell you, it seems to me the most important, by the way, Amanda Milkovitz is the woman who wrote this terrific piece in the Boston Globe. There has got to be a concerted national effort in
yes.
all 50 states, well, some states, to eliminate the criminal statute of limitations.
Absolutely.
I mean,
you and I were
discussing this in the context of corporate criminals a couple of days ago. I don't know if it was who we were talking to, the Attorney General or somebody. But, you and I operate on the assumption if big shot CEOs think there's a chance they're going to go to jail as opposed to pay a fine, they're less likely to do evil things. If 50 states had eliminated completely the statute of limitations, what that means for people out there is if a crime committed against a person, another person, one of these sexual violence crimes committed against another person was discovered at any point and reported at any point, it could still be prosecuted. Now, for those of you out there that say, well, memory's fate, it's like any case.
Yeah.
If it turns out a prosecutor can bring the case, mm-hmm. but then finds out that the witnesses aren't credible or that they've done, then you don't bring the case.
Right.
But you may bring the case.
That's
you're not
right.
precluded from it. And that, to me, is the only way this ever gets put behind
yeah,
it. These guys are worried that by engaging in this sexual violence against
children.
Mostly children, but not all only yeah. children, it's never going to get
I
fixed.
I think that's step one. Step two would be what you all talked to the governor about last week with the RMV. There needs to be a central clearinghouse of all of the names
yeah.
of these folks who have been, suspects and who have been accused so that you don't get the shift of a priest from Idaho to New Mexico.
Right. So what you need then is the sex registry. So pain instructs. Also, it's also embarrassment and shame. So I think that if you make it more, transparent, you might begin to see a kind of shift, not only with those that should be prosecuted, but those that are coming through seminary and going to these local
can I ask
churches.
One last question.
BishopAccountability.org, by the way. Give them a free shout out.
The fabulous work.
There's a great website, BishopAccountability.org. Which listens all the credibly accused priests, all the credibly accused
bishops.
All the
documentation.
What they did, the bishops they're covering up for them. It's a great website, and they've done yeoman's work.
Marjorie, you're the one probably the most time to read this, and I'm embarrassed. I just didn't pick up on it until a couple of hours ago, so I had to skim it. Do we have any idea what's happening to Father Gamache in this situation, who basically not only lied to the Globe, which is not a crime, but allowed a person with a history of sexual assault mm-hmm. to be in and around children in mm-hmm. his parish for ages?
I don't
ages.
Think we know, unless I missed it. I do not think
well,
we know.
I hope
know.
The follow-up is what do the parishioners decide to do when this guy essentially was an enabler
yeah,
of
right.
of this Barbosa character.
And what we got to understand is because there are various gradations of when we talk about sex predators. These priests are at a level 3 sex offenders because they have repeatedly done this. And so the thing that gets me about that, what about that don't they see as not criminal? How could they? And also, I always try to figure out, how do you put on your vestments on Sunday and do communion knowing that you have, I don't even know how you keep even
compartmentalizing. How did the Sacklers decide to addict and kill thousands, because they can and because they have no moral conscience. And the Sacklers belong in jail, and these priests and bishops and all their supervisors belong in jail, too.
Well, it just confirms my belief that that's a culture, and it's a rape culture.
There's a great little anecdote in here where the Eagle Scout you mentioned, Emmett, goes up to communion, and he just about falls off. He has a heart attack because he sees the priest that's about to give him communion is the guy that he knows.
No, not a priest. It's Barbosa, isn't it? Yeah. He's not a priest.
I think Barbosa was giving out communion.
Yeah, but he's not a priest.
No, he's not. He was doing the financial stuff.
He was dressed as a deacon on that particular day.
Yeah. An assistant priest.
But again, good for the Globe once again, and good for this Amanda Milkovitz for her reporting.
Catholic Church still can't even make deacons who are not even priests or like assistant priests. They can't even be women.
And LGBTQ folks can't receive sacraments, let alone be funeralized. So, I mean, this is why I keep saying...
There's a lot of priests. There's a lot of parishes where that's not true.
Yeah, well, again...
There's big deal in my parish. There's a lot of gay people local that are running things.
But you know what? An exception doesn't negate the rule here. I really feel you need an institutional change. I always say this. You can't pour new wine into old wineskins. You got to get rid of the kind of Catholic Church that now exists.
So Bill McKibben, who I thought we knew pretty well, by the way. We've had on a ton of times. Obviously, he started this whole movement with the End of Nature 30-plus years ago. Marjorie, did you know that he volunteers to teach Sunday school at the Methodist Church in Vermont?
No, I did not. No, I did not.
That he attends.
A man of faith. There you go.
And apparently, as a man of faith, he contends that that climate change is the single most important issue for people of the cloth.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a theological belief system about stewardship. It starts in Genesis. We're replete with examples, of it, that we are to be the stewards of society. I tell you what got me, and I think it was last week, I heard it on your show, that for now, presently, we have lost about a third of our birds. And for
that terrible? I think that's pesticides, though.
Is that due to pesticides?
I think it's mostly due to pesticides. I don't think that's – well, I mean, maybe you can link them together. From what I read of that story, it's pesticides.
All right.
And not habitat.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, the whole thing is that we learned this very early on in seminary, that we're to be stewards of the earth, that we're to till and keep the land. And Genesis and all through the Bible is just absolutely replete with it. I think that what bothers me is that while we can lift up that we're now in this sort of ecological crisis with, we don't have climate stability and the ozone layer is chipping away and the diversity in animals are diminishing. How do you get people to really understand this on the ground? Because when I even look at Houston, and I look again now, the Caribbean islands will be hit again with another hurricane. People are being dislocated. You want to stop this sort of immigration problem or refugee problem? Let's address, climate change.
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge crisis. I think that there are too many sound bites out here, though. There are a host of evangelicals who are absolutely committed to this. The terminology that's been used is creation care, though. And
so
it's a different terminology that doesn't get its shine in the media. And a lot of millennial evangelicals and a lot of younger evangelicals are taking a different route than their parents and their grandparents who have historically been deniers. So but there's a huge movement around younger folks who are inspired by folks like Greta Thunberg and other younger people who are saying that you older folks are messing up the potentials of our lives and our futures by not caring about what in evangelical culture, what God intended when God said that I will make you to be stewards, as Irene has mentioned, but also to be the ones to care for what the creation is. And when you go to Noah and look how Noah took care of those animals and took care of the repopulation of the world after the great flood, that this is theological.
But see, I don't think people care about that, you know, the Noah story. I think a couple of things. Terminology is important. So when you say creation, you know, care, people will automatically lap into this notion, this dichotomy of creationism versus evolution. I think that how people begin to understand this, and it has to be people of various faith and of no faith here, when you can no longer plant your garden, when you no longer can go to Whole Foods and get your vegetables because we couldn't plant them this year because the land was either not, you know, we couldn't harvest the land. I think that when we understand that with the temperatures rising, that the Charles River may actually not only flood our basements, but our first floor, rooms. I think that when we see it, in real time, people will unfortunately change. And it bothers me that pain instructs people. And it's really until they begin to understand that, listen, what now affects these people will also affect me.
Who are you trying to change, though? Because that makes the assumption that there's a whole swath of people who are not getting it.
Yeah, there isn't. There isn't.
Well, I think more and more Americans are getting it, which is a good thing. And by the way, since we always bash the Catholic Church, you know who Bill McKibben says wrote the best thing ever about climate change?
I do. Pope.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
Pope. Right. It's been very good on climate change.
Doesn't excuse the rest, you'd agree. But
that's right,
does.
I was going to say. I was just about to say that.
But I agree. And by the way, to his credit, he's relentless. We talk about relentlessness in terms of movements that matter. Yeah. He doesn't miss an opportunity to talk about this issue.
Laudato si, or si.
What does that mean?
You're asking me.
So what'd you say it for, then?
Because that's the name of the encyclical
that
he wrote.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh.
I was just going into a little foreign language there.
There you go. A little Latin.
Marjorie, I was impressed.
All right.
Thank you. You had me.
Say that one more time.
It's Laudato, and then it's S-I.
Oh, I know what it means. McKibben's the man. It
means the man.
That is, I believe.
That's right. The Pope said, we'll throw into Bill McKibben, and then he'll throw one right back at me.
Okay, can we go to politics for a second? Because I'm a huge Charles Barkley fan. And Charles Barkley was on Michael Smirkanish's radio show, Two Philly Boys, by the way.
Yeah.
At least Barkley played, obviously, for the Sixers, and Smirkanish lives in Philly. Former colleague of ours, by the way, who we used to have on the show
Michael
pretty
Smirkanish,
regularly on our old
right.
station. Here is Barkley criticizing the Democratic Party's relationship with the black community.
We need to start holding you Democrats accountable because they've been taking black people's vote, and they only talk to black people every 4 years. All these politicians only talk to black people every 4 years because they want their vote. Oh, actually, the Republicans don't. The Democrats do. But when they get elected, they do nothing in the 4 years in between.
Is that a fair statement by Charles Barkley there?
I would say every 2 years because you have midterms. But yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Listen, brilliant and spot on. But you know what, Emmett? You need to do a disclaimer. Emmett he has no skin in this game. He's not a Democrat, but I have skin in this game here. And he's absolutely right here about that for a couple of reasons. Number one, that's why last week when we had the conversation about reparations, I said they're just dangling carrots because they're really it's about they want our vote. It's sort of like when we had what was the Alabama race
Roy
here.
Moore.
Jones.
Roy Moore.
Right,
Moore.
Right. That like we have no strategy. We're going to save a white male Democrat in a predominantly red state because that's the only time you really want our vote here.
Yeah.
So my point is that they pimp our votes that way, but they also pimp our votes on the Sunday before that Tuesday that you go to the ballot box here. So you're absolutely right. But I do say this here. We became Democrats for some very good reasons. And I just have to say this, that the Republicans, I know it's the party of Lincoln. We're going to get, 40 acres and a mule. We decided that we didn't get that, but that we was just going to take this donkey as far as we could. I think we need to continue on the donkey.
You know, you mentioned the Doug Jones thing for a second. There was a story we read. I don't know what the context was. That three of the most important and closest races won by Democrats were totally a function of African American women turnout.
Yeah.
Lots of key, and there's no. I know you both know this. I don't know people at home. The single most reliable demographic for Democratic candidates is black women.
That's right.
And so I guess you could turn this thing around and
say back to Charles Barkley, why aren't black women, if they're the most reliable voting bloc for Democratic candidates and Democratic incumbents, why aren't they making enforceable demands
on the Democrats who want their votes? I think black women are.
Yeah.
And so let me put my skin back in the game since Irene took it out. So I'm in as an independent what Irene calls the movable middle.
That's right.
Right. And so the Democrats pretty much are going to vote. Irene's going to vote for a Democrat. She gets to pick which one she's going to vote for. The Republicans are going to vote for the Republicans. The point is that it's the independents who you have to convince who should get your vote. And increasingly more black women are moving into the middle space because they feel taken advantage of and feel taken for granted in the Democratic ranks.
I think the Democrats really have a lot of blame. And I don't want to get in a fight with you, Jim, but about the schools. I think that the schools are not working. It's obvious they're not working. And the Democrats really don't do anything about it except talk about more money for the schools. And there's a lot of debate whether it's...
You're right. I mean, listen, we have a divided household in my house because Thea left the Democratic Party. She's an independent here and stuff. I won't leave it because I'm influenced by Shirley Chisholm, who was my, congresswoman here. But you're absolutely right. They want our vote, but not our vices or our interests here. And Trump was right. He said, what do you have to lose? Barkley is saying, what do you have to lose? Then you do something like Elijah Cummings, where you in many ways say that, well, why would you vote for another Democratic candidate pretty much in this rodent-infested area? So you shame a people who have been in those areas. You dissuade them, from coming out to vote. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. But it's not that we are not mobilizing. You're seeing more women black women run for office here. So you're absolutely right. We're not throwing our vote away.
Wasn't Barkley considering running for governor of Georgia for a minute and a half a couple of years ago?
For a hot minute.
Yeah, for a hot second. He was. Absolutely.
Okay. Good to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
Thank you very, very much. And loving the podcast. Loving the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. This is Irene Monroe and Emmett Price are with us every week for All Revved Up. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU. Emmett Price III is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. They're also the host of a new podcast, All Revved Up, which premiered a couple of weeks ago. To subscribe, go to allrevvedup.org. A little programming note. This Wednesday, you can catch Irene at the Cambridge Public Library, Main Branch, 6 to 8:30 for a dialogue on women voting rights. And on Thursday, she'll be receiving an award as one of Boston's 25 most influential LGBTQ and women of color, 5:30 to 8 at Tufts. Coming up, we're going to talk with Heather Goldstone about the UN Climate Change Summit. She's there. She's going to give us the whole scene. She's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Join us online from the UN Climate Action Summit as GBH's science correspondent Heather Goldstone. Heather's an expert in ocean science and the host of Living Lab Radio, which you can catch Sundays at noon right here on 89.7 and Mondays at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on WCAI 90.1. Heather, good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk with you, although I should clarify, there's actually a lot of different climate meetings going on in New York City this week, probably not surprisingly. Piggybacking on the UN General Assembly and the UN Climate Action Summit is one of them, but I'm actually at a different meeting, which is Climate Week New York City. It's run by a private group, the Climate Group, with a real focus on civil society and in particular with businesses and corporations and how the private sector can really affect the climate situation. So a lot going on here, but it's a little bit different than the UN Climate Summit.
So you weren't at the one that we saw President Trump and his entourage go walking out of after they showed up for a couple of minutes. That wasn't the one you were at, I assume, right?
No, I was not at that one, actually. There was a bit of a bashing of President Trump over here where I was today. Gavin Newsom, governor of California, spoke. Governor Jay Inslee of Washington spoke, and actually the morning wrapped up with former Secretary of State John Kerry, who really kind of launched an all-out assault, saying that he was actually announcing a new initiative called World War Zero. World because climate change is global, war because
Some people have declared a war on facts and the truth and common sense and zero, because presumably we need zero carbon to deal with climate. And so I don't think that President Trump made an appearance here at the Climate Week event.
Can we talk, though, about the meeting that he did walk out of? This, correct me if I'm wrong, the whole purpose of this UN gathering this week is to prepare for these climate negotiations that are set for next year as a follow-up to the 2015 original accord. Is that what the agenda theoretically is at the UN?
Yeah, the agenda at the UN, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called this Climate Action Summit because, as you may recall, last fall there was a special UN report on what it would take to limit global warming to a total of 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the more ambitious goal that was set by the Paris Agreement in 2015. And basically what that report said was, well, we need to be about halfway there by 2030, and that's only 10 years away, and we are currently not on track, that our business as usual track is, more like 3.5 to 4.5 degrees of warming is likely what we would see by the end of the century. And so the Secretary General called this meeting to really call on the signatories of the Paris Agreement to show up with not just commitments and goals, but concrete action plans to try to get there. And yes, this leads up to next year, because a key part of the Paris Agreement was that not only would nations make their initial nationally determined contribution plans, but they would come back to those over time every 5 years, report their progress, and make new, more ambitious goals and commitments. And so 5 years is 2020. That's next year.
You know what I've wondered about, Heather? One of the stories that I was reading today said that we're not even, or we are at about 1 degree of warming, or close to 1 degree of warming. So if the stalled hurricanes and the wildfires and the torrential rains, et cetera, are here when we're not even at 1 degree of warming, what does 2 degrees of warming mean?
Well, that's really an open question, right? The 2 degree goal was originally set because, based on the best available science, it seemed like limiting the total average amount of warming to 2 degrees Celsius would avoid the most catastrophic effects of climate change. That's been often interpreted as that would keep us in the safe zone, and I don't think that's actually what scientists originally intended. It was what would keep us out of the most catastrophic zone.
Most catastrophic zone mean?
Well, so that includes tipping points, things like the Arctic tundra, the permafrost, which actually holds more carbon than is currently in the atmosphere, melting and going into a runaway melting cycle where the more it melts, the more greenhouse gases it releases into the atmosphere, the more the planet warms, the more it melts, the more greenhouse gases it releases, those sorts of things. And there are multiple tipping points. There are also tipping points with regard to the melting of ice, and there's some debate as to how close we are to the tipping point of having committed, not necessarily, you know, that all of Antarctica or all of Greenland is melted right now, but that we have committed to a future where all of that ice might melt.
Okay.
And the enormous sea level rise that would result from that. So the thinking was that 2 degrees total warming would keep us away from those kinds of tipping points and the most catastrophic effects. And as the science has evolved, what we've seen is that, in fact, things seem to be happening more rapidly than expected,
yeah,
and the effects seem to be more dramatic and extreme than expected. And that's where that 1.5 degrees goal came from, was a recognition that, you know, 2 is going to be too much. We need to set a more ambitious goal, a less warm goal. But unfortunately, as former Secretary John Kerry said this morning, no single nation on Earth is doing enough to actually keep us in that zone right now. We really need to be doing more and more quickly if we're going to stay within that zone. And actually, what I've heard from most scientists is that what is most likely to happen, because as you noted, we're already close to 1 degree total warming, that most likely what will happen is that we'll overshoot those and we'll need to come back. We'll need to actually pull carbon out of the atmosphere to bring it back to stabilize at that level of, you know, maybe 1.5 or so degrees of total global warming compared to the pre-industrial age, to stabilize the climate
at that point.
You know, Heather, an interesting story by Columbia Journalism Review talking about the fact that the media has been very remiss in talking about climate change, that we almost never do it, particularly when we're talking about the things where it would seem to be obvious, like hurricanes and wildfires and all these things, that we don't like to do it, and that this is supposedly changing because of this new effort by Columbia Journalism School. Even though I just finished reading about the hurricane, the flooding in Houston, and I didn't see much of an emphasis on climate change. So is the media getting this right, or are we still goofing it up?
Well, you know, I'd say things are not going to change overnight. What we saw this past week in concert with the youth protests in the lead up to this week's, you know, high-level meetings, UN and other meetings here in New York, was this effort that was organized largely by Columbia Journalism Review talking, getting something like 250 newsrooms around the world to really focus on climate change for a week. And I think in part that's heartening, although there's definitely a part of me that looks at that and says, really, it's 2019 and we're just mobilizing the media to talk about climate change in a really serious way. That seems like a major oversight. And in fact, Columbia Journalism Review, in writing about the initiative, declined to name any names, but said they spoke with major newsrooms in 2019 and said they just didn't even know where to start in terms of telling the climate change story. And so I think that, you know, without going into just a blame game, I think that's really symptomatic of where we have been with climate change. And in fact, the first speaker of the morning here at Climate Week was the president of Costa Rica, who said, you know, one thing that's really been missing is attention to narrative and the humanity of climate change, that we've focused so much on trying to explain the physical processes and the numbers that we've kind of missed the humanity, and that we need to do a much better job at telling the story of climate change. And to me, that just really struck a chord, seemed really, just totally spot on, that even when we've been talking about it, we haven't always talked about it in the right way. This is a global challenge of a new scope for the entire planet and for all sectors of our society, and that includes journalism. And apparently we're still struggling in 2019 to figure out how to do it right and how to do it better, at least.
You know, Heather Goldstone, you mentioned a minute ago the climate strike on Friday, in part inspired by a 16-year-old Swedish kid, Greta Thunberg, and other young people around the world. Even though I'm sure it made lots of climate activists happy that there was such a broad response, what's the consensus on what impact, if any, Friday had?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I asked a few people here, climate scientists who have been in this business for well over a decade, 2-3 decades in some cases, like, is 2019 really different? And one of the speakers this morning said she really thinks that 2019, when we look back, 2019 is the year that the public perception of climate change shifted, that it became real in the public's mind and something for real action. And I think that in part, the youth climate action movement is really pushing that, right? They're very high profile. It's, many people will tell you, very hard to look a kid in the face and say, yeah, I'm doing absolutely everything I can about climate change, if that's not really the truth. It's hard to deny these kids' arguments. And so that has a potential influence. And for that matter, on a more concrete level, talking with some of the business-minded folks here at Climate Week, they're an important demographic when it comes right down to it, right? Companies want to make sure that they are appealing to young people, because those will be the customers for the next 50 years. And for that matter, those are the people that they're trying to hire into their companies. And corporate leaders are saying that increasingly young people are coming in and interviewing them about their social responsibility and sustainability practices within their companies and forcing them to step up. So I think, you know, maybe not just a protest on a Friday afternoon is not the full scope of what youth activism is doing right now in terms of climate action and the ways that they are putting real pressure on government leaders and on corporate leaders to step up and do more about climate change.
You know, Heather, both at your meeting and at the UN and whatever else is going on in New York City, obviously, while people who care about this issue, which is hopefully almost everybody,
are unhappy about the fact that the current administration is not only not bought in, but is an opponent, for lack of a better expression. They've got a plan for one more year of this administration's denial of climate change, and potentially five more years of denial of climate change. So what's the game plan? I mean, I know I've read that China and India are expected to announce plans today, I guess, or about updating their emissions promises, meaning increasing them, which is great if they adhere to them. But is there a game plan to work around the Trump administration's denial here, or are people just hoping there's a change?
No, I would say people are pretty clear-eyed about where the U.S. federal government is headed with climate policy right now, and we're for the past few years. And in fact, I spoke with Bill Mumaugh, who is a climate scientist who has been an author on multiple of the UN climate reports and helped create the climate group that runs Climate Week. And he said, you know, when they started the group, the focus was on subnational governments, so cities and states, and on multinational corporations, big businesses. And that a lot of people really questioned that approach and said, you know, this is going to have to be multilateral national governments. This mm-hmm. is going to have to be a UN process in order to address climate change. And he said it's kind of come full circle that now there's much broader recognition that where we have been seeing the most momentum before 2015 and since 2015 is at the city and state levels and within large corporations. Also, of course, at local levels, smaller. But, you know, in terms of the really big initiatives and big moves, that's where we've been seeing the most movement. And that's quite possibly where it will continue to be, that this might, obviously it would go a lot faster if there were federal mandates that would accelerate things dramatically. And one speaker this morning did point to the fact that, you know, as soon as President Trump was, that after the 2015 agreement, that sent a signal to the business community that we saw investment in renewables more than investment in fossil fuels in the following year. We saw emissions fall that year. And then after President Trump took office and announced that the U.S. would be leaving the Paris Climate Agreement, of course, it did not fall apart. No one else has left. But that progress did slow down. And we've now seen emissions start to climb. And there was some, you know, hinting that that's because of the lack of leadership at the federal level from the U.S. But at the same time, still hearing lots of momentum and progress from businesses, from cities, and from states, and that's where a lot of people are looking for leadership.
Heather Goldstein, we only have a minute left, but I wonder if Gavin Newsom indicated he's going to prevail against the Trump administration. He wants to keep the emission standards out in California. Trump is fighting him over that. Is he predict victory?
He didn't necessarily victory or not. He mentioned that the state of California currently has, I think he said, 60 lawsuits against the Trump administration, and certainly voiced continued enthusiasm that they are not going to back down and they'll be fighting this fight, and that California, he looks forward to continuing California's leadership on climate policy. But yeah, he didn't necessarily outright say we're going to win, but he definitely said we're going to keep fighting.
Excellent. Hey, Heather, thank you very much. Hope you're not too hot down there.
Thanks, Heather.
Very hot New York City on the first day of fall.
It's pretty toasty.
Yeah,
but,
very toasty.
Good to talk to you.
WGBH science correspondent Heather Goldstein is an expert in ocean science and the host of Living Lab Radio, which you can catch Sundays at noon right here on 89.7 and Mondays at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on WCAI 90.1.
You know, I didn't ask Heather this because she wasn't at the UN. She was at the these other meetings. What do you think was the rationale for Trump showing up so that he could walk out, as opposed to just not being there?
This is just a drop dead to you. This is nothing. It doesn't matter.
So wouldn't have been as dramatic if he just didn't show, which is horrible enough.
Yeah,
he had a show and then show his disdain for those who believe in climate change.
Because last time, remember,
at
the G7 there was the empty chair.
Yeah,
and now I guess he decided to up the ante and have a chair and then dramatically march out and go the whole thing. Because climate change isn't happening; it's a hoax from the Chinese. Up next, poet Richard Blanco is here for another edition of Village Voice. This is a good thing to listen to at this time of day. If you're having a tough time today, keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brodish. She's Marjorie Egan. Join us on the line to lead another edition of Village Voice, where we discuss poetry and how it can help us better understand our lives and times, is Richard Blanco. Richard, as you know, is the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history. His new book, How to Love a Country, deals with various socio-political issues that shadow America. Richard Blanco, good to talk to you.
Howdy.
Hello, Richard Blanco. So I understand you have a particular mission for today.
Yes, which I think Jim is going to love. I want to highlight an anthology called What Saves Us, Poems of Empathy and Outrage in the Age of Trump.
Ooh. I better get that immediately.
It's edited by Martina Espada, and I believe we did a 9/11 poem just last show on one of his one of the best poems from 9/11 last time, but we've had Martin on the show, so to speak, before. But yeah, it's a great anthology. It's due out October 15th, so you can pre-order that, and I'll read a little brief description of what it's doing, because it's not exactly an anthology just about Trump,
right,
which
right,
he would
I
love.
Read that, yeah.
It's called, this is straight from the description on Amazon. This is an anthology of poems in the age of Trump, about much more than Trump. These are poems that either embody or express a sense of empathy or outrage, both prior to and following his election, since it is empathy the president lacks and outrage he provokes.
That's a
well, there we are.
There.
I guess well, that describes the mental state of millions.
Same song, second verse.
Yeah, of Americans. Oh, my God. You know, one of our weekly guests on here is named Juliette Kime. She's on CNN a lot, and she's over at Harvard Kennedy School, et cetera. But she had a great line early in the Trump presidency, which is, pace the rage. And I found that very useful.
To maintain your sanity was her notion, yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. I think that's part of the game.
Yeah.
So, and you're included in this anthology. Yes. You're not, that's what I thought. Are you hopefully you're reading one of yours, are you?
Yeah, I'll read one of mine, which I'm not sure if we read in the past, but I'm going to start with one by Naomi Shihab Nye. This is an interesting piece. It's going to sound very story-like because it's a prose poem, but this is a poem that captured, I think, more of the empathy and the hope than the rage. It's called Gate A4. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal, after learning my flight had been detained for hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of Gate A4 understands Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing loudly. Help, said the flight attendant. Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this. I stooped to put out my arm around the woman and spoke to her, haltingly. Shu da'a, shubid'uk, habibti, santi, sachwai, min fadlik, shubit sewi. The minute she heard my words, she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment the next day. I said, you're fine. You'll get there. Who is picking you up? Let's call him. We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and ride next to her. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons just for fun. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took up about 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling about her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade ma'amoul cookies, little powdered sugar, crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts out of her bag and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There is no better cookie. And then the airline broke out free apple juice from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving it. and they were covered with powdered sugar, too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. Such an old country traveling tradition. Always carry a plant. Always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones and thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women, too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost.
I love that.
So do I.
Why is that a poem, Richard?
I knew you were going to ask that. Well, I do love, there's something that really sneaks up on you in this poem, right? I was like crying when I read this.
Beautiful.
It sort of leads you into the space of what is just a wonderful reflection of true humanity, right? And so what makes it a poem? That's a great question. It is a very, very prose-like story. Like, the one thing I think that makes a poem always, it's that it's not driven by plot per se, and the satisfaction of the poem is always not sort of like whodunit or finding out, you know, what's the climax and the conclusion, but rather an emotional satisfaction. By the end of the poem, much like a song, I think you just feel a different kind of satisfaction. And here, of course, it's we're ending with, you know, of course, it's much a story, but we're ending with this beautiful satisfaction or emotion of connection, belonging, and hope, right? It ends on that note. And it's also very compact. I mean, that's another thing that makes a poem, you know, this could be, you know, a short story. It would be several pages long, maybe. So that's one of the primary differences. A prose poem is interesting, though, because it's always, it's mixing those genres, right? There's no line breaks in a prose poem. So there's a sense of when you want to tell more of a story-like poem, we sort of do away with the line breaks to just keep the language flowing in a different way, among other things. But it's still an emotionally driven a piece. It's still about satisfying us emotionally, again, like a song might do.
It's a great story, though.
It's a great story. And this is in this book, What Saves Us, yeah. Empathy, Outrage. It's in that book, correct?
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry if I didn't mention that.
No, and I just want to make sure.
Because I was in the airport shortly after 2016, and it was this weird feeling of complete disconnection. Like everybody was sort of looking at each other's eyes, not knowing who one another was. And yet you have these wonderful moments that once we get past our stereotypes and our fears and... when you see those moments when the best of humanity happens, you're like, yeah, maybe there's hope for us. Maybe there's hope for all of this, right? And that's such a beautiful moment that she captures. And I think that's another thing that makes it a poem, you know, noticing something or focusing on something like the cookies, right?
Yeah, the
cookies become
sugar.
This bonding moment, right? Only a poet, you know, the poet is always looking for that small detail that means the universe.
I love where she said, and I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, and goes, there's so many beautiful images in this thing. It's perfect. It's perfect.
Yeah, and what I love about Naomi's work in general, she's Palestinian and I think went to high school in Palestine, grew up the rest of the time in the States and lives in San Antonio. You know, she carries that sense of beauty, humanitarianism, that sense of love, even when she could... Even you know, when she tries to, I mean, she could speak out of complete outrage, right? But she always takes it the step further about, you know, ending us. I always say poets should offer us a way, a hope, something, a way out beyond calling attention to what needs to be called attention to in a social political context. She always takes us further, right? She always takes us to this other place where we can feel we can hold hands with everyone.
I've experienced things like this at the airport quite regularly, haven't you, Marjorie? As
yeah.
people line up, zone number three.
Fighting tooth and nail, get in front of you in line. Yeah, exactly. No, I have not experienced it.
Well,
but
you know,
there's always hope.
We've done traveling poems before in the past, right? And so airports, anywhere there's, especially airports, are like, there's just like the best and the worst of human nature comes out, right?
It's like, absolutely. so let's hear the complaint of El Rio Grande.
Sure. This is in the anthology, but it's also obviously from the latest book, How to Love a Country. And I was trying to deal with, I think there's an affinity with this other poem that I wanted to leave us in some sense of space and connectedness while still complaining. I've lived in Guatemala. I've done some mission work in Honduras. And so I know that it's much more complicated than usually the news lets out, this idea of what's going on with immigration and with our border, really, what's beyond immigration, really. So I wanted to sort of find a way to talk about that and talk about the absurdity of these man-made idea of borders and of nation states, which is really becoming an outdated idea to hold on to power, wealth, and just control, right? So I decided to write the poem in the voice of a river, so the river can speak to us and shame us all, shame humanity, and perhaps give us a different perspective on what we're doing on this planet. Complaint of el Rio Grande, Foilin Barberi. I was meant for all things to meet, to make the clouds pause in the mirror of my waters, to be home to fallen rain that finds its way to me, to turn eons of loveless rock into love-sick pebbles and carry them as humble gifts back to the sea, which brings life back to me. I felt the sun flare, praised each star flocked about the moon long before you did. I've breathed air you'll never breathe. Listened to songbirds before you could speak their names, before you dug your oars in me, before you created the gods that created you. Then countries, your invention. Maps jigsawing the world into colored shapes, caged in bold lines to say you're here, not there, you're this, not that, to say yellow isn't red, red isn't black, black is not white. To say mine, not ours, to say war, and believe life's worth is relative. You named me, Big River, drew me, blue, thick, to divide, to say spick and Yankee, to say wetback and gringo. You split me in two, half of me, us, the other, them. But I wasn't meant to drown children. Hear mother's cries. Never meant to be your geography, a line, a border, a murderer. I was meant for all things to meet. The mirrored clouds and sun's tingle, bird songs and the quiet moon, the wind and its dust, the rush of mountain rain, and us. Blood that runs in you is water flowing in me, both life, the truth we know. We know, be one in one another.
Yikes.
Okay, let me ask you a stupid student question. Is that the use of a inanimate thing? Well, I don't know if you really call a river inanimate, but becoming human.
Personification.
Yeah, personification. You know, this is obvious, Richard. I feel like I say obvious things so often after your poems, but I think probably I'm not the only person that never thought of this from the perspective of the Rio Grande. I just didn't.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the poetic tools that you'll find, you know, out there. So you're at my just personification. When we write a whole poem based on that voice, then it becomes a persona poem. So, I mean, I can do it in the voice of my grandmother. We've heard that one before, right? But in this case, yeah, there was something, again, it was when something gets complex, we try as poets to find a new way to connect it, to connect the dots, so to speak. And like I said, you know, it's much more complicated and one-sided than just, you know, oh, you know, United States bad, you know. And there's a lot more going on in this situation than I think we don't talk about, which is a more of a geopolitical power, trying to hold on to power. I mean, I've lived in my in these countries, and I understand that there's, you know, the same kind of race. There's also, you know, that kind of abuse along racial lines. There's that kind of power, trying to maintain power. And so, you know, even though the United States has done a number on Central America, another thing we don't talk about these days, right? Even though a lot of these migrants and refugees are are displaced because of the drug trafficking, which is largely our consumer demand for drugs. Right? None of this sort of these nuances make it into the news sometimes, and just really again, I don't know. when you try to take a step back and try to think about how I think the river's trying to say, listen, if you all don't get along. You know, there's more at stake than just weighing in on one, you know, just weighing in on one side, or just, you know, a one beat kind of poem. And it's really interesting. I never really thought much about this poem because it came too easily. And sometimes the poems that give you the most trouble are the ones you think are your best poems, and you love to read them all the time because they're like the bad children that finally do some good in the world. But the ones that give you a lot of trouble, the ones that are coming home at like 4 a.m. in 8th grade, those those poems, you kind of like want to show them off because they took you so much blood, sweat, and tears. And then someone told me this poem does something wonderful, and I think it's exactly that. By stepping back, it lets us see some other, I think, dimension about what we're doing as not just between two countries or between a border, but what are we doing as humanity? What world have we built where we can't have empathy and for each other and just try to understand something beyond all these ulterior motives? Anyway, it's not like I'm running for office, but jump in, please.
Maybe you should, Richard.
No, before I didn't know you had spent time in Honduras, and we've learned talking to Ali Narani from the National Immigration Forum, it has the highest murder rate in the world. Guatemala, far behind. What were you doing? What were you doing there?
So I spent time. So that's who this poem is dedicated to. Aileen Bayberry is. I spent time with a poetry project with my dear friend Spencer Reese at an all-girls orphanage in San Pedro Sula, which is the murder capital. I think that's usually where they quote the statistics, and a lot of it has to do with the drug. With the drug trade and the gangs that have sort of formed around that. So we worked there. He worked there a whole year. I worked there a few weeks, just working with the girls and teaching them English and poetry. But really, it's just also just being there for them and having them think through the world through language. And Aileen, I ended up sponsoring. And she's now luckily has graduated from the school there and is on her way to, hopefully has her eyes set on law school. So
good for her. That's
immigration
fantastic.
Law, of course.
Hey.
So, Richard, those are both great. So different. So great. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
And the book, again, that they come from, which is going to be out in October, as Richard said, is What Saves Us, Poems of Empathy and Outrage in the Age of Trump. Richard, thanks again.
I'd pre-order if I were you, Marjorie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I know.
Two dozen
exactly.
Christmas gifts.
Thank you so much, Richard. Richard joins us regularly for Village Voice. He's the 5th presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history. His new book, How to Love a Country, deals with various sociopolitical issues that shadow America. We are done. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can always find us by way of our podcast on iTunes. Tune in tomorrow or join us live at the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library for Senate President Karen Spilka, our sports authority, Trini Kuznarek, and CNN's John King. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley, our engineer, John the Claw. Parker, what's on TV, Jim?
Well, we're going to continue a discussion you and I started a couple of hours ago off the tweet from Ocasio-Cortez when she said, at this point, the bigger national scandal is in the president's law-breaking behavior. It's the Democratic Party's refusal to impeach him for it. We're going to have two or three Democrats joining us to see if they agree with their fellow Democrat, Ocasio-Cortez. And then Liz Neslaus has a terrific story. I mean, you've heard the story before about an old house being turned into a bunch of condos. What makes this one different is the house is linked to one of the city's most notorious criminals. Yes, that particular criminal, an answer to your face. And then
we talking about Whitey Bulger?
We might be. You have to tune in tonight. And then Christopher Kimball, who you know from everything Cooks Magazine, Cooks Illustrated, America's Test Kitchen, and now Milk Street. He previews the season for us and a lot of other things that Milk Street is working on. So Chris Kimball's with me tonight.
Sounds good, Jim.
I think it is.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Have a great afternoon. And please, if you're around, stop by the library tomorrow. At least tune in 11 to 2. Thanks.